This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Come on. We call it the place to be.
Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
It is contagious. It is the place to be, and we are live each and every Monday.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
In the club, them want flex with us. To get next with us, them can vex with us. From the day my bond, I ignite my flame. Girl, I call my name, and it is my fame. It's a good girl, turn me on. Till I earn them on, let's get it on. Let's get it on, till I earn them on. Girl, it's a good, just turn me on. Girl, don't sweat it, don't get agitated. Girl, go on, rotate, car, anything you want, you know.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to the great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this President's Day Monday evening inside the PTBN studios, as always. And of course, joining me too on this evening is my PIC, Mr. Scott Criscola. Scotland, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Happy President's Day to everyone in the States. I wonder if there's a happy Prime Minister's Day in Canada. We'll ask our third member of the triumvirate. Welcome to episode 481 of the longest-running episodic motherfucking Goaltended. And, long weekend, JR. How are you? How are things? How's the ankle?
Oh, better. Thank you. I pegged myself around 93%.
Okay. We're trying to play, like, the vignettes, you know, like Super Sky Billy Graham. Yes. So we didn't have to, you know, hit you with a fucking, with a metal spike into a dead
steroids,
cow. Like,
the steroids are working, so I'm good.
Okay, good. The nandrolone's right here.
I'm good. So, yeah, we got about 5 weeks till hoops season kicks off, so I think I'll be good to go. I'm going to get an ankle brace just for safety, but I'm feeling good, so.
I would be good. Yeah, I think that's a smart idea. Well, at least you don't have to worry about shoveling for a little bit, because the next 2 days are going to be, like, fucking
No, I'm done shoveling.
So.
I paid, even though it got melted in, like, 3 minutes, I paid the other day, and I will continue to pay for the rest of time. Okay. I'm done walking on any sort of ice.
guy on the lawn.
Yeah, I don't care.
Only on the lawn.
Done with that. But I am, I want to get a brace, because I feel like once you have an injury like that, it's like never really as strong as it used to be. Like, I feel like you're more.
No, it's true.
Right? You're probably more likely to have that happen again just because shit gets stretched around in there. So I'm going to get a brace, learn to play through it, because I don't want to, you know, week one, go out there and come down hard and fuck it up again. So.
Yeah, no, it's smart. Smart idea.
Full of them.
Let's bring back, speaking of prime ministers, JR, why don't we bring in the third member of our team this evening? First time, long time, in the immortal words of a FAN listener, it seems like.
Not quite, but if we were like the Blue Bloods, I guess he'd be the Earl to our Lord and Sir, and that is, of course, Mr. Kelly Nelson. Kelly, how are you?
Doing great. First time since my beloved Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl, so
congrats.
That'll be my last plug for that.
No, you can plug away. It was a highlight for me. Well, it's funny because...
Did you get free beer mailed to you like those that went to the fucking parade?
No.
So I don't think we've actually talked about it on this show, but So me and Andy Flanagan are like just diehard haters, and the whole ride back and forth to the Rumble in Philly, all we had to hear about was these honks just going on and on about the Super Bowl, and we're just like ready to blow our heads. So I tell him, like, you know what? We've tried, like, because it worked for the two Giants ones where me and him and my parents would watch, and we tried it for the Seahawks, and that they shit the bed. We tried it for the Falcons, and they shit the bed. So, like, okay, we're done with that. So he came over, and we did not watch the Super Bowl. We just hung out. And then we put it on with 2.5 minutes to go. So I saw from when the Eagles kicked the field goal to go up 10 or whatever. Wait, what happened? Did they score again after the fumble? I saw the fumble. Whatever.
Yeah, they scored a field goal after the fumble.
All right, but
they did kick a field goal after the fumble.
But
yeah,
there was one before the fumble too, right?
Touchdown.
Okay.
Before the fumble,
I think we saw that touchdown. Whatever it is, I put it on around 2.5 minutes. So I'm like, all right, we got to watch the end. He didn't want to at all, but I talked him into it. So we get to watch the best part of the game, which is the Eagles winning. So that was it. So I did not watch this whole game yet. I've seen the highlights. At some time, I'll probably watch it, but I couldn't do it again, you know, because I didn't have any faith that the Eagles could win. So I'm glad they did it though.
I didn't watch a minute of the game either, just because I couldn't think of the lesser of two evils, because I can't stand either of them. So I really didn't care either way. I actually put it on right around the same time you did, JR. So
it was a good night.
I just think it's great. Only in Philly do they give away free beer. Like, that crew actually needs free alcohol to fucking celebrate. I mean, be honest with you.
It was cool. It was cool being in Philly Rumble weekend, though.
Yes.
A lot of Eagles pride flying around, and people, you know, just all over the place going crazy about it. So that was kind of a neat atmosphere.
Admittedly, it was pretty cool to be in a city that was about to go and again be the underdog. Yeah. Of course, they had the whole mask and all that jazz. So, but congrats, Kel. And now you can go back to the rest of your mediocre teams and shitty Blue Jays.
Sounds familiar, Scott.
So.
I don't know what you're talking about.
it was a long time coming. And no, if the Cowboys were in the Super Bowl, I wouldn't have watched a single second of that game. So, and also, there is no Prime Minister's Day in Canada. Today, though, is a holiday in a lot of Canada. It's called Family Day. But in the part of Canada that I live in, BC, for some reason, Family Day is a week earlier, so a week ago. Was a holiday in BC called
Hart Family Day.
It's just a made up. It just was invented literally like five
Stu
years
invented
ago.
It.
Maybe 10 years ago. I can't remember.
So do you have to do something with your family on that day? If you don't, are you in trouble?
It's become like that thing where, like people make an extra effort to go out and do, you know, family related things. But it totally just created in the last 10 years because there wasn't a national holiday in February before that.
Should be one anyway, because curling's on. I'm watching that right now. Italy and Sweden in a battle in the fourth. I do enjoy curling. Have you watched any Olympics, Kel?
I've caught a little bit here and there. I'm not a huge Olympics guy, and which is funny because Canada actually does pretty well in the Winter Olympics. And curling, I despise the sport of curling. I'm sorry. It's as boring as anything there is on TV.
I don't think I could, like, sit and, like, it's good background fodder, like, right now. You know, just kind of glance up at it. If I actually had to, like, sit here and study it, I'd probably go a little stir crazy. But I do like the Olympics. I've watched less this time than I thought I would. I don't know if it's just probably just a time thing for me. But the last few, I've watched a lot more thanks to the app. Like, I'd have it on the side on the iPad a lot. I think the time is messing with it a little bit. Like, the last few, you know, I was able to, if I was home, working from home, like, there was stuff on during the day. It feels like this is either, like, replays at night or early in the morning, you know?
Yeah. And also, the Canadian hockey team is not the pros this year, so who cares?
Well, none of them are, right?
So that's, none of them are, anyway.
The
Russians have some former great players, and they'll probably win the whole thing, but...
That takes some, you know, stank off of that, though, right? Like, the hockey's always, like, a big highlight, and it's still cool, but it does take a little bit off, like, not seeing the pros, I think.
Yeah.
I've watched a decent amount. I'm a summer Olympic fan anyway. I like more of the events in the summertime. Although the summer in 2 years is going to be the same as this, because isn't it somewhere in China or Japan?
China.
It's in the Far East again, I think, so the times will be all whacked anyway.
It's in the Orient, as Lee Marshall
and
others.
Exactly. Those fucking Orientals are hosting.
Yes.
I've watched some hockey. I've watched a lot of skiing because we got some, besides Lindsay, we got, what's her name, Michaela Schifrin and a few of the slalom skiers. So we've won a few medals there. That kid, the kid that looks like Zuckerberg, fucks his name. Gerard Red Gerard, whatever that
Gerard
name is.
Gerard Depardieu, is his name.
Gerard Depardieu. I don't even think he's that tall. you know, he went. So it's been some cool things, but and the figure skating's been pretty solid. But I've always been a summer guy. I like hoops. I like all the track and field and that kind of stuff. And again, the U.S. hockey team is probably the one country that benefits the least, or I should say, is affected the most from not having NHL players, because that was like the one vestige of them being relatively competitive. I mean,
unless
I watched the other day.
That was the only one.
Well, yeah. Well, they were fantastic. They pulled lightning in a bottle in 1980. It's tremendous.
I guess I won't go into my Olympic. I think I've done it on here before. I won't get into it. My medal rant about how it's stupid that, like, you can win golds in individual one-time event things, and then, like, basketball or hockey, you need to win an entire fucking league to, like, get a gold medal. You know, like, that shit always bothers me. It's like, you can win one race down a hill and you get a gold, but you have to beat, like, nine basketball teams to get a gold.
That is true.
So that's always bugged me. I think there should be tiers of medals, but that's me. And that's not to take away from other sports. Like, give me a slalom tournament that, you know, goes days, and then you get the gold. But,
well, I guess it kind of does, because you got to do – you do ski more than once.
How many times?
Yeah, there are heats. Yeah, it goes. Yeah, there's.
I think it's three, like, three or four. I get what you're saying. Like, it feels like that the team sports have to work harder, but it's not like you ski once and then you, and if you finish last, you suck.
Some of them.
No, it's not like that. It's not really like that at all. It's close.
Sounds about right. All right, let's talk about Madison Square Garden.
All right, let's go to the Garden. All right, Busy week in wrestling, guys, because the next our next three episodes, JR, tonight and the next two all air, I won't say happen, but air within 5 days of each other. So we have this show this evening, and then, of course, the premier pay-per-view, the premier pay-per-view in a couple of days, and then we have a nationally televised event on Saturday. So busy week in professional wrestling, at least in the World Wrestling Federation. We begin tonight. The date is November 24th, 1987, from our office on 33rd and 7th in Manhattan, Madison Square Garden. Quiet week, obviously. They didn't spread out the they didn't spread things out that often. Because the only other thing that Graham has on this day, the IMA Sports Arena in Flint, Michigan.
Jeez.
And all it says is included Don Morocco.
To me, he just showed up there and that was it. It was the actual show.
The Rock, yeah, The Rock showed up. So that's it. So obviously some of the big players, obviously like Hogan, Andre, a lot of them all had the week off, or at least the beginning of the week off. Right. To get ready for Thursday in Richfield, which we'll talk about next week, or in a couple weeks.
Someday.
So there you go. That's it. So what are the rest of our facts, JR?
These all aired 5 days apart. We're recording them like 5 months apart, but, you know, it's fine.
No.
All right, here's the greeny notes. Since our last MSG show back in October, October 24th episode of Superstars, Jimmy Hart announced he was the new manager of the Glamour Girls, the women's tag team champions. So, hot commodity there. Following a match with King Harley Race, Race had a confrontation with Jim Duggan in the aisle. Neither man was willing to let the other pass. Duggan hit Race with his 2x4 after Race pushed him. Moments later, during a bout featuring Jim Duggan, Race came back and was held back by officials, but then came in to confront Duggan with a chair. Duggan again hit Race with a 2x4 before stealing his robe and crown. I'm pretty sure my kids enacted this exact fight tonight in the earlier today in the snow. A shove out of the way, 2x4. On 10/31, Superstars, Demolition defeated Brady Boone and Scott Casey. When Axe pinned Boone after the contest, Billy Jack Haynes tried to make the save for Boone, but after Boone sustained two more decapitation devices, but ended up receiving one himself. Ken Patera then came out, and he was attacked too with the cane, sustaining further injury to his arm. Boone was taken to the back on a stretcher, so it looks like maybe some semblance of a feud building there. On the 11/7, Superstars, Strikeforce defeated the Hart Foundation to win the Tag Team Championship at 9/08 when Jim Neidhart submitted to Rick Martel's Boston Crab, so a major title change aired on Superstars. I'll pause there. You guys, obviously I wasn't watching at this time, enough how in tune you guys were, but any thoughts on that title change and how it went down, how shocking it was, if at all?
I thought it was a little...
For me, that was a huge moment.
Yeah. Okay, Cal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I was a huge Tito Santana fan, and it didn't look like he was really going anywhere for most of 1987. Then he gets put in a tag with Martel, and I can still remember watching that match and being shocked and so happy that Tito got another belt. And yeah, it was a big moment, huge moment of my early fandom.
Yeah, I was pretty pumped. I think we knew it was coming because I was watching these MSG house shows as a kid on Channel 9 and on the MSG network, and you know, all the Cindy's. Strikeforce seemed to be the team prepped. I didn't know if it was. I didn't think it was going to happen this early. I thought maybe it would be after Survivor Series. So I was stunned when it happened. When I saw it on Superstars and it actually happened, I thought it was going to end in a schmoz, and then we'd get like maybe, you know, the Rumble or something. But I was. I don't think the actual title change stunned me. The fact that it was on a Cindy stunned me. I was watching on a Saturday morning. I'm like, oh my God, we have new tag team champions. Like, that never happened. You know,
yeah.
I was stunning enough to happen in June with Honky and Steamboat. This was ridiculous. Yeah.
Pretty
like,
big
oh
year
God.
In 87 for televised title changes. But I guess you guys wouldn't have really been in the know. I'm curious how much you leaked before it aired. Like, do we know how far in advance it was taped before it aired?
I think a few weeks.
Yeah, so.
Let me see.
Obviously, it was out there. I mean, you guys wouldn't have known, but...
I mean, yeah, if I had a subscription to The Observer as a 10-year-old, I would have known, but...
yes. Yeah, I had no clue.
Should have been with the times, buddy. yeah, so I think it's a pretty big surprise. I mean, Strikeforce has been well-utilized, but they've really been kind of back and forth with the Islanders, like, since their formation. So it's not like they dominated that feud and were just wrecking people en route to the title. So I could see it coming across as kind of a shock. Because the Hearts have been pretty dominant since they won the belt earlier in the year. So, so there you go. You got that. The next week, superstar Billy Graham defeated Butch Reed by DQ, and the one-man gang interfered. After the bout, Gang hit three splashes on Graham's injured hip before Don Morocco made the save. While Morocco was brawling with Reed, Gang hit another splash on Graham outside the ring, which is credited as ending Superstar's career. Of course, we talked about him a couple times here recently, most recently last week with Landy. Billy Graham, as we'll talk about next week, was scheduled to be at the pay-per-view, ended up getting knocked out of action via this, and pretty much has his career ended. So I guess that hip was not quite holding up.
All right. So, yeah, just to confirm, I guess it was what? About a week and a half apart. It was live. The taping occurred on October 27th. And then aired on November 7th. So that's what, 10 days or so.
So, all right. So they kept it pretty quick.
Yeah.
All right. So. So let's get into the action. We have Gorilla Monsoon, Nick Bockwinkel, and Lord Al Hayes welcome us in, set up the night ahead. So Nick Bockwinkel back for another month. Well, any thoughts quickly on Bock, Kelly? Well, we can talk about it as we go along, but just him in general coming into this role.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's a refreshing change, or at least that's what I thought when I started watching this show, because I haven't really been a big fan of the Gorilla Lord Al team.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just not really that good. So I thought, okay, Bock's in here, a new voice, fresh voice. And I love Bock as a wrestler, as a promo. He was awesome. So I had a lot of hope for this, let me say, at the beginning. But we'll see how that pans out.
Okay. We'll see if you felt the same way, that he added extra work for me because he talks so much more. There's a lot of extra notes. Because he says, like, good stuff, but it's just, like, so much more than, like, even more than, because Bobby's a lot of quips, whereas Nick has, like, these long fucking diatribes, but we'll get to it. All right, our opener has a big debut here at Madison Square Garden. Frenchie Martin, oh my god. Big debut of the Ultimate Warrior taking on Frenchie Martin. And the Ultimate Warrior, of course, born in 1959, James Brian Helwig, was an amateur bodybuilder competing in a lot of national pro contests, winning the Mr. Georgia crown in 1984. Helwig started training with weights when he was 11 years old, moved to California, hooked up with bodybuilder Robbie Robinson, and that's where that all took off. And then, of course, later on became a professional wrestler when he was joined a bunch of other bodybuilders. Garland, Donahoe, Mark Miller, and Steve Borden. Warrior accepted the invitation, abandoned his bodybuilding career, as well as his plans to become a chiropractor, to become wrestling as a wrestler as Jim Justice Helwig, as Power Team USA formed group of bodybuilders trained by Red Bastien and Rick Bassman. Later wrestled as the Freedom Fighters. Helwig was known as Justice and Borden as Flash. They moved over to Continental Memphis under Dutch Mantel, became known as the Blade Runners, Rock, and Flash. They moved to Memphis, again run by Jerry Jarrett. Team played baby faces at first, but the crowd was slow to take on to them, so they became heels. Blade Runners went on to wrestle Mid-South, which became UWF in 86, and Watts created the Blade Runners with the intent to make them a parody of the Road Warriors. That's according to Road Warrior Animal. Part of Eddie Gilbert's Hot Stuff International group, disbanded in 86, Helwig left, went to Dallas to World Class, where he wrestled for $50 a night under the name Dingo Warrior. Was a member of the World Class locker room. Initially was a heel, managed by Gary Hart, and then eventually turned to becoming a face after an issue with Percival Pringle III. Here we go. Pringle, protégés Buzz Sawyer, Matt Bourne, after a six-man match turned on him, Warrior formed a team with Lance Von Erich, competed for the WCWA World Tag Team titles. November 86, Warrior and Von Erich defeated Master G and Matt Bourne to win those straps. They held the championship until December, lost to Al Madrill and Brian Adias, our old buddies from the adventure. In 1987, Warrior began competing for the Texas heavyweight title, losing to Bob Bradley in a tournament final. Won the title. It was held up in April of 87 when Warrior left. He was reinstated as champion upon returning, but vacated it again when he left once more to join the WWF. Took on the name Ultimate Warrior, began appearing on house shows in June, initially as Dingo Warrior, when promoted by Gene Okerlund, soon had his name changed to Ultimate. There is a dispute amongst them over who actually created that name. Bruce Pitcher said Vince McMahon did not know what a dingo was, and because there was a modern-day Warrior, and the Road Warrior should not be more than one simple Warrior, but the Ultimate Warrior. Warrior claims after one of his first matches, McMahon asked him to a pre-tape promo. And Vince said, we want you to do Warrior, but don't be Dingo. And Warrior said he called himself Ultimate Warrior. So, as always with those two, they're always snipping over a property. But here we are. So our big opener, Frenchie Martin and his beret returned to MSG to battle the Wild Ultimate Warrior, making his debut. Warrior with his rock music already in place gets a big pop as he charges the ring. Gets some talk about the advantages of face paint as Frenchie begs off some lockups. Warrior shakes off a shoulder block and hip tosses the hefty Frenchie. Gorilla wonders how big Warrior's arms are, but Nick says it doesn't matter in the end how big things are. Warrior shoves Frenchie right out of the ring, and after regrouping, Martin returns. Nick accidentally says the Road Warrior instead of the Ultimate Warrior, and then we start talking about whether or not he can wrestle. Warrior wins a test of strength, but Frenchie lands a blow off the middle rope and punches away. Warrior ignores that and slams Frenchie down hard, sending him to the back outside to nurse his shoulder. Frenchie slowly gets back in and begs off as his shoulder looks all fucked up. Warrior chops and clotheslines Frenchie and then pins him very easily. And to me, I think it's pretty clear that Frenchie was hurt and it cut the match short because it was kind of chugging along. He takes that nasty bump and then he's just grabbing his shoulder the whole rest of the time. And then Warrior just easily pins him. The match stunk. Warrior's presence is impressive, though. The crowd's really into him. I went dud on this. I'm guessing Frenchie's shoulder played a role, but I don't know if it mattered either way. Probably would have sucked regardless. What do you think, Scott?
Your match length is 438. I gave it a dud as well. And, I mean, it served its purpose. That's all I'll say. It served its purpose.
Yeah,
so. I don't think you were going to get a match much longer than that anyway, injury or not. I think the purpose early on of building this Ultimate Warrior was to see him squash a bunch of stiffs, work his way up the chain, and then, you know, after we get into the new year, you know, he'll start facing halfway decent competition. So, injury or not, I think the match wasn't going to go much longer anyway. I mean, did you really want to watch 11 minutes of Frenchie fucking working him over with arm bars and crap? Absolutely.
Oh, no. I think it was always going to be pretty short, but it's clear the injury happened because there's nothing happens after the injury. Frenchie just rolls around holding her shoulder and then Warriors.
Oh, no, you're right. Yeah. Out. Oh, no, absolutely. I'm just saying I don't think it was going to go much longer than another minute and a half anyway. So, Kelly, nothing much more to say here. Just a simple stage for this new jacked up dude to show his wares and kind of get the. It kind of be a guy to be kind of a different. I think their goal early on. What do you think? Two things, besides obviously your comments. And secondly, do you think, and JR, I'm curious your thoughts as well. Did Vince go in with this guy thinking, hey, I need another, you know, I've got Hogan. Now I've got kind of got Savage, who's kind of a fan of the older, like older teenage 20s wrestlers. Was Warrior a guy that was going to cater to the kids because of the face paint and the craziness? Do you think that was Vince's thought, like off the bat with him?
I don't know. I don't think he saw him as like a huge star and a future main eventer right away because he kind of just sticks in the middle of the card for a good about a year into his run before Vince straps the rocket. The look, I mean, he already had the face paint look before he came to WWF, so that wasn't a Vince thing. But yeah, this is early Warrior where he was still wrestling basically like traditional style matches, and if you've seen other matches with Warrior in them from this time, they're all pretty bad because you know you have actual holds going on and stuff. You don't want to see that with the Warrior. You just want to see him kick ass, get in the ring quickly, in and out, maintain his aura, and so this one was well on its way to being pretty bad. And it was bad for what we saw. Frenchie Martin was actually a sub for Bob Orton Jr. That would have been a very interesting match, actually. we'll see. It would have been interesting to see what Orton would have gave the Warrior and how that would have went.
Right. We haven't. Orton's not a guy we've seen job a lot either. So I'm curious if he would have just laid down clean for him.
Yeah, and that. I mean, he was gone basically. Yeah. So he was. Yeah, definitely into like a JTTS role. But Frenchie, this was a legit injury because he doesn't wrestle again. I looked until May 1988. But he wasn't really wrestling that much at this time anyway.
Yeah,
and I think he starts as the manager for Bravo pretty soon. But yeah, that was bad. And I don't think it was really Warrior's fault on the body slam. It looked like Frenchie just stuck his arm out.
Yeah, and landed fine.
Took a bad bump, but I think he probably broke his arm or dislocated his shoulder or something. It was definitely off, and then Warrior like did the clotheslines afterwards. Everything looked bad. This was just a horrible match. And Frenchie still, though, even though he's fucked his arm up, he still does the kick out at three
Still an asshole. the
bitter asshole veteran.
Warrior should have stomped at his fucking shoulder after the pin. Well, he might have been pissed, too, that he probably figured. He probably blamed Warrior, you know what I mean? So he was probably pissed. He's probably, fuck you. I'm surprised he didn't do the roll out to the floor and stay there and take the count out so he doesn't get pinned. Blame the injury.
That'd have been hilarious. A pretty auspicious debut for Warrior at the Garden.
It was kind of unique. It was unique seeing him like open the show. You know, like that was it was kind of neat in a way. I get the idea of getting people fired up. So his last match was in St. Louis on November 7th. Bob Orton, that is, fought Sam Houston to a draw.
Oh God, he couldn't even get a decision out of it.
His last TV match was the prime time right before this. He lost to Duggan in 4:42. So that was the 11:19 prime time. Looks to be his last TV match. So. And that's it, right? He never comes back?
No. He went to the AWA right after this and actually worked a tag with Adrian Adonis. But it was a very brief run, like 3 months, tops, right. 4 months.
Then he went to, didn't he go to Abrams UWF, I think, too?
He works there. He went to WCW in 89. He was there.
Yes, he was. Yep.
Yeah, when they brought in a bunch of old WWF guys and none of them really did anything.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't see him again for 18 years. Well, wow. 17 years, I guess. Hall of Fame.
Right.
Wait, when did he go in? 05?
Yeah, he went in WrestleMania 21 with Piper 18
years,
and Hogan.
So. Yep, 18 years.
All right, there you go. So let's move along because we got a big match coming up next. And it is our women's tag team title bout featuring the champion Glamour Girls battling the Jumping Bomb Angels. Norio Tateno and Itsuki Yamazaki formed one of the most well-known teams on the Japanese women's wrestling circuit in late 1985. January 86, the Angels defeated Bull Nakano and Kondor Saito to win the vacant WWWA World Tag Team Championship. On March 20th, 86, Lioness Asuka and Shigusa Nagayo, the Crush Girls, defeated the Angels to capture the tag team titles. Of course, the Angels will then migrate here to take on the Glamour Girls in a extended feud, which we'll see a few more times between the two of them. Jimmy Hart leads out the women's tag champs, the Glamour Girls, who have some upbeat music accompanying them, which I thought was kind of funny. Both Martin and Kai look to have aged quite a bit since the last time we saw them, which wasn't long ago. I thought Judy Martin, when was it that she had that match that we watched? Was that like mid-86? Remember that really good match where her and Desiree Peterson or whatever beat the shit out of each other?
Yeah.
I think
it was even 85.
Yeah, sure. So maybe it's been a couple years. She looks like she aged like 10 years since then. And I don't know if it's the makeup or the gimmick or what. Or the way they did her hair. It's like they purposely did their hair. Like even Leilani Kai looks younger when she comes back in like 1994 than she does here. Like I don't know if it was just the way they made them look. And I don't know. I keep getting confused. They did a good job with the blonde hair too because Kai was pretty distinct looking. But when she's in the ring, unless you really see them like close up, they're hard to tell apart.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know if you guys felt the same, but... The age thing,
a little bit, yeah. I mean, look, Judy Martin's Judy Martin. I mean,
but she wasn't that old, right? We looked it up. I thought. I mean, she wasn't that old here. I swear, it's the hair combined with the makeup or something like that. So she was born in 55. So she would have only been fucking like 33 here. Like
that's crazy.
You know, that's like Braun Strowman. That means he's like 33. You know what I mean? Like that's not. Crazy old or anything, but she looks like I think it's the way they made
her
up.
Here we are making fun of Judy Martin all these fucking years, and she's younger. She's younger then than we are now. It's like what the fuck? So bizarre.
Like Tori Wilson was at the Royal Rumble and is like 10 years older than Tori Wilson is like 10 years older than Judy Martin is here.
I don't think the outfits were very flattering either. I mean, we're watching it this morning, and we're both like, and Greedy and I are like, wow, she. Judy Martin's got a lot of junk in the trunk. It's like, you know, and she trimmed down a little bit, but I just don't think the outfits were very flattering.
It's everything.
Maybe they weren't meant to be. I don't know.
They purposely made them look like old and haggard.
Yeah. Like the name Glamour Girls, it was supposed to be ironic because they're not glamorous.
They're hags.
Yeah. I mean, they pretty much portray them as that. So it's weird how they did a good job, I guess, the makeup and the, they look like the grannies or whatever from Glow and the, whatever the fuck they were. All right, here we go. Jumping Bomb Angels get a nice round of applause, and they stretch out as they prep. Nick says the Yankee girls will have a tough time. Gorilla's interested to see what Hart has added to the Glamour Girls, and Nick puts over Jumping Bomb Angels big time. Zatanno starts off with Kai. She just flies around the ring, dominating both champs. Yamazaki tags in, keeps up the pace, chucking Martin around the ring, and the crowd's just going bananas. Zatanno heads up top and takes Martin over with an arm drag, and the girls convalesce with Jimmy, who Gorilla says now has three titles in a stable, along with the IC and tag. I guess the, well, when did the Strike Force, did that air after this? No, it was before this, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's funny.
He says
three titles,
he
so
did have three champions now.
Right. So maybe I misheard what he said. Kai tags back in and cuts Zatanno down with a chop and slams her for two. Zatanno slips free and tags out. Yamazaki lands a monkey flip and sunset flip for two. The girls bail and regroup, and Kai is back in and lands some knee lifts, but Yamazaki lands a dropkick and tags Zatanno, who lands a knee drop off the top for two. The crowd is just eating all of this up. Zatanno works the leg and tags Yamazaki, who comes off the top with a senton splash but comes up empty. Kai bounces up and starts to work the back before tagging Martin, who does the same. The girls continue to double-team and break out all the tricks to dominate Yamazaki, who gets a visual pin, but the ref is tied up in the corner. Kai hammers away and grabs a head scissors as Gorilla says she's lost 15-20 pounds, which is funny to hear him say about a woman's wrestler. Martin tags in and shoves Yamazaki to the mat and stomps away and then grabs a chin lock. Yamazaki takes Martin down but can't make the tag, gets trapped in the corner once again. Kai returns and Nick thinks the JBA have emptied their tanks in the first few minutes and couldn't get it done, and they're cooked now. Yamazaki gets a near fall on a sunset flip and then makes a tag, but the ref didn't see it and blocks it. Kai whips Yamazaki to Martin, who kicks her hard in the chest. Kai covers, but Yamazaki bridges out. The girls keep double-teaming. Kai gets a scorpion deathlock as things are breaking down while the girls maintain control. Yamazaki bridges out of another cover, and then a moment later, the champs collide, and she makes the tag. Zatanno cleans house, and the crowd is just erupting. She grabs her near falls as Nick is criticizing the way she's going about her attack. Zatanno gets a cover on a crossbody off the middle rope, but Kai breaks it up and kicks the ref. Gorilla thinks that should have been a DQ, but doesn't call it. Things break down some more, and the Angels whiff on stereo drop kicks, but bridge out of the covers. They ram the Glamour Girls into each other and both head up top, where they pelt Kai with stereo drop kicks, but the ref is tied up in the corner, and Judy breaks up the pin. Judy crushes Zatanno with a powerbomb, and Kai covers to steal the win to loud boos. The Angels clean house after the match, and Jimmy escapes before they can get to him. But goddamn, what a fucking match that was. Nonstop action. The crowd loved every second of it. The Angels were amazing. The Glamour Girls hung right in there with them, never slowing any of it down, working a tight, tight heat segment. Yamazaki during the heat was awesome, too, and she kept desperately getting sunset flips. Like, that was her go-to. The hot tag was real good, too. The finish was awesome. Martin just tops off all the chaos with a fucking powerbomb. Delightful match. A ton of fun to watch. I went 4 stars on this. One of my favorite matches we've seen on these MSG shows. Yeah, just out of nowhere, Kelly. I love this one.
Yeah, I do too. I've seen it a few times now. Marty and I reviewed it on Tag Teams Back Again. It was one of our favorites from that show. I just love the Jumping Bomb Angels. I loved them when I was a kid, when they came on the scene in 1987. They were, you know, so exciting and doing moves that none of the men were doing, and it was just so cool, and it was like a brief flash and they were gone. But yeah, they're so exciting. And it was such a breath of fresh air for 1987 WWF to have them come on the scene. It was great. The Glamour Girls are great, too. Judy Martin's a really, really good wrestler. Super polished. She went to Japan numerous times. And so did Kai. And they learned a lot of different offense from the Japanese, because Martin uses a power bomb, other moves that you weren't seeing in the States. And I think the story was that Martin and Kai had this idea that they would bring the Jumping Bomb Angels over and try and revolutionize women's wrestling, or at least in the WWF, because they had spent a lot of time in Japan, worked with them, got really excited about how different wrestling was in Japan, and how, you know, because the whole, we all know the story of Moolah sort of dragging things down, and you know, there was a lot of good women's wrestling in the 80s in the States, but Moolah had this stranglehold on the whole scene, and
the girls themselves, she had a stranglehold.
Yes, yes. Figuratively and literally. But the scene had become very stale, and there was no progression. And they it was kind of a power play, I think, they tried to make, but Moolah just had too much power. But anyway, that's for the future. To this match, great. I mean, it's the MSG crowd just is so appreciative of the jumping bomb Angels. The Angels win the crowd over within seconds, coming out at full speed. A bunch of fast-paced offense. The crowd just goes batshit for that. I love that. That's awesome. It's so funny because this was the Jumping Bomb Angels debut in MSG, and in the previous match, we had the Ultimate Warrior make his debut, and it's like night and day. I mean, Warrior got a decent pop coming out, but the match was the shits. But whose legacy, of course, is so well-remembered. It's funny how it all started out. Yeah, great match. Yamazaki, great face in peril. So great with sympathy, like just the look on her face where she's pretty much just almost crying, desperately trying to make the tag. And just, yeah, she loved the sunset flip. There must have been, she must have busted out about six
she kept
different
going for
ones. So that was a little strange, but cool. The double dropkick from the top rope spot was awesome. That was such a huge move for the time. Yeah, the crowd just loved that. And yeah, the finish, you know, keep this going, keep the heat with the Glamour Girls powerbomb, like I said, by Martin for the finish. And yeah, this was revolutionary stuff at the time. And the crowd just, like I said, just ate it all up. Great stuff. Very, very good match. I went 4 stars too. Because, you know, it gets that extra boost just for being unique and fresh. And, you know, it's a special match from this time. It's amazing to see. This was 30 years ago. And it's women's wrestling, you could argue, is just caught up now, like in the last couple of years. This was a definite, like, glimpse into the future at the time. Really, really good match.
Scott, before you go, I just want to say, too, that, like, it wasn't, I think the thought process has always been, like, the Angels came over and kind of, you know, they're the ones that changed everything. They were revolutionary. But, I mean, I just want to give the credit to the Glamour Girls, too, because they are, like, the Angels are great, but I'm not sure they could have these matches with, like, anybody else at this time. Like, if you stick some of these other women in there with them, I don't think you're getting this. So I think they deserve so much credit, too, for hanging. And, you know, Scott, I think, you know, we probably owe an apology from 7 years ago, whatever the hell it was, that we first did these shows and we talked like Survivor Series 87. I think we were just like relentless bagging on the Golden Girls, you know, like that was a running joke. Even our old written reviews too. And having watched more of like Kai and Judy Martin doing these shows and then really paying closer attention to these matches between these two teams, you just realize how much it was all for like putting in the work and getting the match done. Like, I don't think the Angels have these matches with anybody else, maybe, at least within the construct of the WWF. Of course, they could have brought in other females from, like, Japan and stuff, but with who was on this roster, the Glamour Girls were the ones that could hold up their end of the bargain. So I just wanted to give some props to them, too.
I'm going to as well. I also gave it 4 stars, almost gave it 4.5. Your match time, 13:59, and it was a sprint. Mm-hmm. It didn't even feel that long. Yeah, before I get to the Bomb Angels, I want to, first of all, the crowd, and I like your point, Kelly. We always think that MSG crowds are like kind of drones. They cheer for the faces and boo the heels, whether the match is any good or not, who gives a shit. But I think they definitely move for move. And I've noticed that a lot of these last, like, you know, year of house shows, we've had a lot of technical stuff that we didn't really get much of the first 2 years, 85 and 86. I feel like we've got a lot of it in 87. I feel like the fans are not as, how do I word it? The older fans, like, I mean, I was 13 or 14, so I wasn't totally, I enjoy good matches, but obviously didn't grasp the term work rate for many, many years. But I have to say, I think the MSG crowd,
to be honest,
the full crowd. Oh, that's only if you do it though. The thing is the crowds really do appreciate good work. And I think this was a good example of it. They could have just kind of passed off this match and moved on to the next stuff because the big celebrities were coming up next, or the high profile guys were coming up next. But they really did appreciate move for move how good these four women worked. And I want to mention that too. And I just want to back up your point, Kel, about how there was legit respect from the MSG crowd for that. So the Glamour Girls, because you need to. You not only have to be able to pinball around the ring for the Bomb Angels offense, and you got to land that right, or else it'll just look terrible. So kudos to Judy and Leilani Kai for that. But they just knew how to work the crowd. and be really good. They were like, in a roundabout way, and it's funny because Jimmy managed them, they were like the Female Heart Foundation. I don't know who you would think Brett would be because neither of them were high flyers by any stretch, but and they were both in better shape than Anvil, as we'll see later. But they definitely had the same kind of style as female heel tag team like Brett and Anvil did. Very grinding. Very like, you know, they ground these two girls into the dirt because they were so light. They were easy to chuck around. The best thing that they did was they figured out, all right, we got these two women that are fucking 105 pounds soaking wet. They're Japanese, so they'll take any bumps. They'll let us throw them all over the place. The crowd will go nuts. And it's just, it's easy. The chemistry was easy. And that I applaud Leilani Kai and Judy Martin for, because they knew how to figure out the psychology of, all right, these girls are going to make a huge comeback at the end, but we really got to knock them out. And knowing that they're much smaller than we are, we could really lay into them and really make it look good. And they did. And that made that comeback at the end, the double drop kick and all the stuff they did at the end, absolutely insane. And the crowd fell right into it.
Yeah, I think Bockwinkel played into that too, how he kept talking about they emptied the tank, they blew their load, you know, basically like everything out of the gate, and now they got nothing left. Like, I thought he did a good job telling the story there too.
And speaking of Bock, I want to say, and Kel, we talked a lot about this on the last house show. Bockwinkel, the problem he had in the first show was he was still cutting like his heel AWA promos, so he was going kind of long-winded. He wasn't really doing quick heel comments or quick comments during the match. He would be very narrative, so he was going a little too long in his comments because it almost like he was still cutting his heel, AWA world champion promos. Mm-hmm. This show and this match in particular, he finally realized, all right, I gotta tighten this shit up and hustle along, and he did. Particularly now with Alfred, you got a third voice you gotta fit in, and he did a great job with that. So kudos to Bock. He definitely got down the whole way of doing it, in this setting. So it's not as much of a narrative like AWA announcing, which they're so slow and drolling, and it's not like that here. So that helped the match too, and I think it kind of helped Bock out kind of get more comfortable with the WWF style of announcing. 4-star match. Totally forgot that these two have been wrestling since June, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So they really set the rest of the card up from here. Mm-hmm. Great match by all four. And yeah, you're right, JR. We've been trashing these women for fucking 7 years. And meanwhile, she's fucking 33. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
It's on them. They portrayed her as being old. I mean, and then, as we'll see next week with some of the hags she's with on that team that they're with, by association, they look old as well.
The outfits were never flattering. I mean, these two piece fucking bathing suits.
They did not make them look. And maybe it's by design because they're feuding with the Bomb Angels, so they want to really play off like here's these super young, athletic Japanese girls against these aged veterans.
Right.
If you want to hear more,
great match.
Yeah. If you want to hear more gushing, Jeff and I on an episode of Jeff Lynn's Wrestling actually watched this and he fell in love hard. He's crushing hard on the Jumping Bomb Angels. So he's seen them a bunch of times now. He's seen this match. He's seen our next two pay-per-views too. So he's seen plenty. And he's a fan. So definitely tons of gushing, tons of love on this match and this feud out there on our network these days. So check it out.
And also check out Steve Riddle, who on the site today, PlaceBeNation.com, did his pre-Vintage Vault viewing and he did this match. So he gushed as well.
A lot of gushing. All right, up next is a big rematch from last month, and that is Paul Orndorff taking on Ravishing Rick Rude. It is Orndorff's final MSG match, Scott. We'll see him next week, but this is pretty much the last time we'll see him in this venue. Kelly, last time you'll talk about him. Any quick thoughts on Orndorff as an MSG competitor?
I think he had a great run at MSG from 84 to 87. A lot of hot matches. Of course, the main event of WrestleMania 1. Big feud with Piper. That was one of the highlights of that era. A lot of cool matches. Great as a heel and great as a face. And he had a really good run. But at this point, there wasn't really much left for him to do, unfortunately.
It really is a changing of the guard happening here, right? I mean, you could like we talked about Orton leaving. We're seeing Orndorff leave. There's a few other guys like Rude coming in. Duggan coming in. You can definitely start to see the turning of the roster here heading into 88. Oh, Warrior coming in.
Big time. Yeah.
And we'll see it again in another year. Like, the end of 88 is like another big one.
Yeah.
But for now, we're seeing definitely a lot of turnover happening. And, yeah, I wonder if, I mean, with the second, we talked about this a little bit last week, too, like, with the second face turn, going back to feuding with Bobby again, it's kind of like, all right, you know, we've kind of been there, done that. Like, I don't know what else he could have possibly done, really.
Yeah, even as a 10-year-old when this happened, it felt stale and you know. It
right. Just,
but, I mean, as we'll see in this match, the crowd was totally behind him.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he could have hung around as a like contender for Honky. Like, we talked about that, I think, in the past. Something along those lines, perhaps. But all right, big rematch. Orndorff looking for revenge yet again on his former manager. He promised last month he'd put him down for good. Rude and Bobby are out first. That stripper music. He gets booed, as usual, and shits on the crowd and strips down. Orndorff and Humperdinck are out next to a big pop, and the grudge match is all set. Rude meets Paul on the floor, but Orndorff dominates and batters Rick all over the place. Paul chases Bobby off and continues to bring the heat, slugging Rude, who ends up hanging from the middle rope. Orndorff hammers away and chokes him with a cable until he tumbles free to the floor. Paul keeps punching away, blocking Rude from getting inside, as Nick wonders what else Paul will be allowed to do out there. Paul decks Bobby and poses as the crowd is all revved up. Rude tries to jump him. Paul turns and decks him and then hits an atomic drop and clothesline before dropping an elbow. Keeps punching away, but eats a Rude knee on a charge. Rude gathers himself and lays in some hard strikes to the neck and back as Al talks about Rude's great physical conditioning. Bobby joins in the booth and says Paul jumped him as he was just passing by. Rude goes to a chin lock. Paul stands up and falls back to break it. Rude blocks a splash, though, with his knees and gets back to work with his hard strikes to the neck. Rude fights through a comeback attempt and keeps stomping and hammering away, but Paul fires right back with a flurry, drops Rude with a real hard right hand. The conditioning talk continues as Paul sends Rude over the top of the backdrop and picks him up during a pin cover, which Nick calls dumb, of course, giving Orndorff a bit of a visual pin there. Paul hammers Rude with a clothesline, but Bobby gets on the apron and hooks Paul. Rude swings wildly and decks Bobby by accident. His hump is tying up the ref. Rude is able to roll up Paul and hook the tights and get the win. Orndorff batters Rude after the bell and whips him into Bobby. A real fun match. The crowd is red hot. Paul's on fire. He looked fantastic, which, you know, we're saying he was kind of done, but I mean, really, I thought, like you said, Kelly, he looked great here. Rude is kind of bland on offense. Bumping was really good, though. Strong feud, nice way to get Rude established. Paul was red hot for a minute there, and maybe a big face run could have worked. I don't know, but they were clearly starting to run out of time on his clock, but he the crowd still loved him. He was still over. So, Scott, I went 2.5 on this one.
I went 2 stars. Your match time, 8:44. First thing, you can tell that Rude is still a little nervous, still kind of getting his gimmick down because he kind of rushed the whole "what I'd like to have is for all." You could tell he's still trying to get that down. So he was, you know, he had some nerves and he kind of rushed it, which is fine. He gets it down eventually, obviously. Yeah, Rude's offense, I have a note about this here, and I'm curious your thoughts too, Kel. It doesn't suck.
No, it's I thought it sucked.
I think the problem is, I think it's too basic. Yeah. Punches and kicks are nice, but we need a little something in between.
There's like nothing there. And I'm curious to see how it develops with him, because obviously he's regarded as one of the greats. You know, it's reflected, and we'll see with the voting with the GWWE. But this and some of the stuff to come, I'm curious when it turns around for him, because right now he is kind of bland to watch in the ring. He's not doing much. He's more gimmick character and bumping. And it almost makes you wonder, should he be on a face based on in-ring? But go ahead, Kelly. Yeah, I'll let you answer that, too.
I mean, it was...
Or not.
It was... Well, I'll get to that in a minute. I'll Kelly, form his thoughts. But yeah, there's something wrong with that... With his offense. That's why I had to knock it. I saw you had 2.5. I couldn't go that high just for that reason. But I know that eventually down the line, he does fix it a little bit. Orndorff is looking pretty hot. It's kind of crazy. I like having Humpy here now. It does add a different dynamic. We haven't had a babyface manager since, you know, that big fat sloppy pig. So it's nice to have a different face manager. So, sadly, there's nothing left for him, and the roster is getting, you know, filling with slots that he's not part of. But I expected more out of this match after having it again, you know, another month. So Kel, yeah, 2 stars. And as much as we love Rude, I agree with JR. I think early on, I don't think we realized that offensively, he's not as creative as he probably needs to be for a heel.
Yeah, I mean, that's a knock on Rude that would follow him his whole career, even at his peak and his best years in WCW in the 90s. Yeah, he got better just through experience, and he worked with so many great wrestlers. But yeah, his, you know, chin lock fest matches, there's some real, you know, duds with Rude in the early years in WWF, for sure, where just nothing goes on. He just doesn't do anything on offense. But as a character, he was so memorable and so charismatic. I mean, it just, you remember all that stuff, and, you know, his matches are secondary, and that was kind of the WWF style anyway. But no, he does improve. But he was still relatively new at this time, and relatively new as a big-time pushed wrestler. But this match started really hot. Orndorff came out on fire. You know, felt like a grudge match. Crowd was red hot. Orndorff strangled Rude with the microphone cord. So I was thinking, okay, we're going to get a pretty good brawl here. And, you know, it didn't really turn out that way, obviously. But it was going well. Orndorff had nice hope spots when Rude was in charge. But then the finish came super abruptly. And it was a crummy roll up with the tights finish, and yeah, it just deflated the crowd. It you know, this could have been more. Orndorff was hurting. You can see the arm issue that he had with atrophy in the one arm, where it was clearly smaller.
Yeah, we noticed that last month too.
Yeah, and that happened when he was feuding with Hogan the year before, and because that feud was so hot, he never took time off to rest and heal. And it would affect him for the rest of his career. He actually, after he leaves WWF, he doesn't really do much until, gosh, like 92, 93. He took a lot of time off and just popped up.
I think he's in WCW in like 90, isn't he? And then he leaves again.
Yeah, it was like a super short run where he's buddies with Sting briefly and all that. But no, like, real run of note until he has that TV title run with WCW in 93. But no, he could still go. And when he does come back, or when he goes to WCW in 93, he was great. He didn't miss a beat. But unfortunately, yeah, the injuries had taken its toll on him. But yeah, I went 2 stars in this match. It had a great start, hot start, and then just ended. So I couldn't go any higher, but.
Yeah, so Orndorff's last match is with Rude on January 4th. So, he barely gets into 88, which makes you wonder why Rude didn't, like, I don't know. Maybe they didn't know he was leaving, but it's like, why not put Rude over him stronger than this? It's like, they clearly had plans for Rude, but whatever, for whatever reason, they dance around it. Looking at Rude now, he's definitely a guy that is, like, character built for a heel, in-ring built for a face, because his selling and bumping is great. I mean, maybe it's too exaggerated to be a face. I don't know, but he, it's too bad, because you're right. So I'm glad you guys noticed it or called it out too, because I'm curious to see if that turns around at all, or when it does in this run, or if maybe it's a guy that's kind of been overrated in ring for his WWF career.
Yeah. I think time will tell. The issue is
maybe,
you know,
Warrior carries him.
I think he definitely looks better by the time he gets to 89. 88 is the year that I'm curious about. By the time he gets to 89, like, you know, well, he doesn't wrestle at the Rumble, but I'm curious some of those mid shows before we get to WrestleMania 5. By 5, he's fine. So something happens in 88 that he kind of expands
the
repertoire.
We'll see. It may be a memory for you. We'll see.
I think the other promotions, like Crockett, I mean, Crockett, he was in a tag with Manny Fernandez for the most part. So he got hidden there. He was, you know, world-class champion. But when you're facing the Von Erichs, you kind of don't have to really do much, you know? So now maybe it is being exposed a bit, but we'll go from there. Anyway, back to the tag circuit, JR, for our next match.
Yeah, we'll see. So this is the Killer Bees taking on the Bolsheviks, and that's Nikolai Volkoff and his new partner, Boris Zukov, who's replacing the Iron Sheik, who, of course, had been fired after the cocaine issues with Jim Duggan. Born James Harrell, 1959, Roanoke, Virginia, inspired by his Northside High School football coach and hoped to become a pro wrestler. The wide receiver and defensive halfback Harrell became interested in gaining mass in his senior year, exercising at the YMCA, met Rick McCord, introduced him to Don Hogan and Steve Savage. There you go, ahead of their times. Two wrestlers from Salem, Virginia.
What were they, the moderate powers?
Right. Yeah, the forebearers. Together, they toured small towns of Virginia before moving to Atlanta a year later. In his first big match, a 210-pound Harold, now called Jim Nelson, teamed with Mike Stallings to lose to Ivan Koloff and Ole Anderson. After 4 years wrestling in different territories, he worked in 1982 as Private Jim Nelson in Sergeant Slaughter's Cobra Corps and Jim Crockett, frequently teamed with Don Knotel and feuded with Porkchop Cash. In World Class in Texas in 83, debuted as Boris Zukov, a hired assassin by Skandor Akbar against Bruiser Brody. Went to Alabama, continued his feud with Cash there. In 85, debuted in AWA as Boris Zukov. I'm sorry, he was Boris Zukov, I should clarify. In
yeah,
World
Zukov,
Class.
Yeah.
He's Boris Zukov now in the AWA, billed from the Soviet Union. Zukov adopted Chris Markoff as his manager, challenged AWA World Champion Rick Martel and Sergeant Slaughter, the America's champion. In 87, formed a tag team with Soldat Ustinov under Sheikh Adnan Al-Kassi's management. The pair won the AWA World Tag Team titles that same year. Zukov, however, left the AWA for WWF while still half, seems to be a trend, yep. while still tag team champion. As a result, former tag team title holder Doug Summers was brought into team with Ustinov, losing to Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee. It's funny how these guys just don't give a fuck what belts they have when the WWF came calling in like 87, yeah. 88. They just went. They're like, yeah, I'm not passing that up. See you later. Even if it's to be a low-level job team. And Nikolai Volkov. So here we go. Slick leads out his fairly new team. Zukov in to replace the Sheik. Team has a lower profile, still dangerous. Nikolai sings the anthem to booze. The Bees come charging out to warm welcome. They've been hot with the new mask gimmick, of course. So another chance to notch a win. Al says the Bees have made steady progress and now are a good veteran team. Nick talks about Boris Zukov's giant head and the joke about not likely having a big brain inside of it. I thought it was kind of mean. Then debate where from Russia he's from. Perhaps close to Siberia, they settle on. The Bees put on their masks and Slick and the Russians flip out, but Gorilla says Jack Tunney's office has decreed them legal. The Russians stall and threaten to leave. After a couple of minutes of nonsense, the Bees take off the masks and stick them in their tights. Boris finally gets back on the apron and Al says they're all disjointed. Boris and Brunzel eventually get us going with Boris using his power to counter Jim's speed. Nick and Al keep calling Boris the junior member due to his lack of seniority in the U.S. The Bees tag in and out, punish the arm of Boris, who eventually kicks free. And tags Nikolai, who enters and hammers away at Blair. Blair works free and tags Brunzel, who goes right to the arm again, picking up a one count and a roll up. Nikolai lands a punch. Brunzel trips him up and tags Blair, who starts to work the leg to keep the Russian grounded. Nick and Gorilla debate the perceived disadvantages of being on the mat. Nikolai breaks free and tags Boris, but Blair takes him right down and tags in Brunzel, who gets a jackknife for two. Al says the Russians start to show nothing at all. Slick pops in to bitch about the double teaming. Blair comes in and twists away at the leg some more, but Boris escapes and tags Nikolai, who finally uses his power to slam Blair and grab a front face lock. We get some double teams, heel tricks, quick tags, as Al says the Bees blew their chances to put this away. Nikolai gets two on a nice gut wrench and hooks in a tight bear hug. Blair hangs on and goes to the eyes, but Boris gets a tag and keeps control, getting a suplex, but he twists his knee on the way down. Brunzel breaks up the pin, and Boris tags out and shoves Blair to the floor. Boris hops down and spikes Blair's back of the apron. Back inside, Nikolai stomps away, throws Blair into a choke before dropping him to the mat. Blair sneaks in a sunset flip for two, but Nikolai kicks him in the back and tags Boris, who goes to a front face lock. Brunzel breaks it up, but the ref forces him, and the Russians double team. Boris drops Blair with a boot for two and goes back to the face lock. Nikolai comes in. They land a double elbow before shoving Blair outside. And, of course, that's when Brunzel hops down. The Bees go into the apron, put their masks on, and the bell rings by accident. One of the Bees comes in and is hot and cleans house, so it's clearly Brunzel. Brunzel levels Boris with a great dropkick, tipping off his identity there. Nikolai stomps Brunzel, and Boris lands a power slam as Nick thinks there's a conspiracy with the bell ringing. Things break down. Obviously, he's never watched an MSG show before. Things break down. Eventually, the Bees switch, and one of them hits a high cross body on Boris for the win. Fun paint-by-numbers tag match, a little long. The mask stuff is shrewd, but kind of shady for the faces. The heels all have a point that this is bullshit. The commentary is good here, too. The Russians look fine. Boris is sloppy, but he had some moments. The Bees get a win and buzz on. I went 2.5 on this, Kel. I want your thoughts on the match and also your thoughts on the mask stuff for a face team.
I don't know. I mean, with being the Bees, for I don't know, for some reason the mask thing fit with them.
So you're saying all Bees look alike?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I guess it's a little shady, but it popped the crowd, and that's all that really matters. They're going against the Bolsheviks, the hated heels from Russia. I mean, really, I don't have too much sympathy for them. For me, the match was too long. So much stalling. at the start. I couldn't believe how long it was going. And then the Bolsheviks threatened to leave just like the Red Army hockey team left the ice against the Philadelphia Flyers in 1975. There's a deep cut for you. Yeah, and the Bolsheviks, they're such a paint-by-numbers heel team. Just Nikolai's singles matches in the last few years have been dreadful, one after the next. And then it's unbelievable that now he's in a team that's going to last for like almost 3 years, I think. Good for him to, you know, that he was able to keep going. But man, Bolsheviks, I've just never really had much interest in them at all. Zhukov, you mentioned the AWA run. I'll just get this plug in. If you want to see some really great Boris Zhukov matches, his three-match series with Rick Martel for the AWA title is excellent. Just really good stuff. It culminates in a cage match. Bloody. Really good stuff. It used to be on YouTube. Hopefully it probably still is. Actually, they don't take down AWA stuff. So look up Boris Zhukov versus Rick Martel on YouTube and enjoy. But this match, you know, like I said, too long. And I'm a fan of the Bees usually, especially Blair. I just found it hard to care when they're going against the Bolsheviks. The crowd, there wasn't much heat for this either. They didn't seem to really care. And yeah, this was just one of those matches that just didn't really do it for me at all. Technically, it was fine, but my heart wasn't in it. I just couldn't get interested in it at all. I went 1.5 stars, and I'm hoping not to see too many more Bolsheviks tag matches going forward. That's just my one wish.
So I've been high on both of these. I don't know. I feel like whenever it's like a proficiently fine tag match, like 2.5 is like my base. You know, it's just like, all right, they didn't really do anything bad. They didn't rise above that, but
yeah.
Your match time, and this is kind of almost like an illegitimate match time. The official match time is 20:26, but how much? They probably wrestle what, maybe 14 minutes, because the first six is because the bell rings and then they do all the fucking around with the masks and the Bolsheviks almost leave and their bell had rung before all that, so that was technically part of the match time. So technically they actually wrestle for maybe 13 minutes. And, you know, the first seven is them goof, you know, all the mask shit and everything. So I gave it 2 stars. Quickly, I did go on YouTube, and I found it looks like a regular match from August 22nd, 1985, between Zhukov and Rick Martel. And then the cage match is November 14th, 1985, from Winnipeg.
Yeah, I think all three are from the Winnipeg Arena, actually.
Yeah, and I don't know what the second – I don't see a second match. So, and former Canadiens hockey legend John Ferguson is the special guest referee for the cage match.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So, anyway, so just type Boris Zhukov versus Rick Martel on YouTube, and you can find at least two of the three matches.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I just wanted to – thanks for saying that, Cal. I just wanted to look that up. Yeah, I agree with JR. I mean, the match is fine. It's nothing – The mask stuff is starting to get a little stupid now, because it's just illogical for a babyface team to fuck over the referee. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I don't get it. It's almost like the Bees are desperate as a team. I'd almost turn them heel, but I think they'd be an annoying heel team. I don't know. I'm not sure. But the match is fine. I thought it served its purpose, worked well. You know, it made the Bees look kind of, you know, mischievous, and it made the Bolsheviks look dumb. I might have even had the Bolsheviks go over. If you're going to have Nikolai have a new partner, you might as well at least let him win something. But in ring, it was fine. I mean, you know, I think Nikolai needed something to kind of rejuvenate himself. Otherwise, he would have floated even more aimlessly than Orndorff or anybody else. That's, you know, that was in the early, you know, the beginning of the pay-per-view era. So, good win for the Bees, even though it was, you know, a little devious. And
so those Ruskies get fuck them,
fucking commies, those pinkos.
All right, let's get to our next match here. That is the rematch that we've seen many times, and that is Randy Macho Man Savage taking on the Intercontinental Champion Honky Tonk Man. Third battle between these guys, second time in MSG. Feud is red hot. Even more molten than Saturday's main event. Honky and Jimmy shimmy out to the ring, cockier than ever, title in tow. Savage and Liz march out to loud cheers, and Macho goes right at Honky, chasing him to the floor and then all around the ring. Savage catches up and shoves him into the barricade and then the post and then smashed him as he crawled into the apron. Honky makes it back in, but Savage throws him right back out, hammers away before slinging him inside. Jimmy ties up Macho's leg as he climbed inside, allowing Honky to clobber him and go to work. Savage turns the tide and blocks a sunset flip and rams Honky to the corner. Follows with a back elbow that knocks Honky outside, and then slams Honky and Jimmy together. Back inside, he keeps punching and choking away, but Jimmy comes in to run interference, giving Honky a shot to deck Macho in the gut. Nick calls out Macho for getting distracted and not staying focused, and the crowd fires up a loud Macho chant as Honky works him over. Savage makes a brief comeback, but Honky dodges a charge, and Macho slams into the corner. Honky throws him back outside. Liz helps Macho get back in, catches Honky with a crossbody for two. Al says he thinks Savage is conserving energy and sucking Honky in a bit. Honky lays into kicks and shot to the throat and then keeps dropping knees and fists. Jimmy gets involved again, choking Macho and knocking him to the floor. Honky pulls him back inside, sends him flying with a high back body drop, and then tries to go after Liz, but the ref slows him down. Honky makes it out there and stalks her as Gorilla Allen Nick says, stupid, wasting time. Honky threatens to slap her, but Savage bolts outside and makes a save and starts to batter Honky around the ring. Back inside, Honky begs off, but Savage spits in his face and elbows and punches away. Hart hops on the apron and hooks Savage, but Macho ducks and Honky pelts his manager by accident. The crowd's going nuts as Savage pummels the champ and slams him and goes up top and hits an axe. Another Jimmy Hart distraction. The two collide in the ring and Savage falls to the floor. Jimmy ties up Macho again, but Honky slides out and they brawl. Savage gets the megaphone, snaps, and drills Honky in the back, drawing the DQ. Al and Gorilla debate if it's a countout or DQ, and Fink confirms it was actually a countout. The crowd was not pleased with that one at all. Savage grabs Jimmy in the aisle and beats on him, and then Honky and shatters the guitar and Honky's back to a huge pop, which was a great spot. Fun as usual, great heat. I thought it was a step below their best stuff that we've seen, Saturday Night's Main Event and the other MSG. I feel like they're getting a little formulaic, like Honky every match goes out after Liz, the ref comes out, Savage goes out, Jimmy keeps running interference over and over and over, which I know is the act, but I think these two kind of need to be separated at this point. Savage molten hot as a face, though. He needs to get away from Honky or win something, because they keep doing these fuck finishes because they don't want the belt off Honky yet, and Savage can't lose. So they gotta get them apart. Honky continues to work hard. He escapes with his gold. His clock may be ticking as champion, but this has been a great feud. Tremendous heat, fun action. And again, Honky has carried his end of the load very well. It has not been just Savage. I went 3-star Scott, so a tick below their past work, but still a lot of fun.
Your official match time, 13:24. I gave it 3.5. I loved it. I thought it was close to matching their previous Garden matches. Savage is just getting it more and more with every match. And when we get to our grades later, I've got an interesting thought finally on how these MSG house shows are put together, particularly when Hogan's not around. I know we would talk a lot about that. Bockwinkel continues to be really awesome, and his logic continues to make matches better. And he's finally, again, as I said earlier, he's figuring out quick hits, particularly now that, you know, in October it was just him and Gorilla. Now when you add Alfred, you got to fit another voice in. And I think he's done a good job of getting used to that now. The finish kind of harkens back to a legendary finish of a legendary match in the building, but in reverse. It kind of reminds me of the Snuka Morocco cage match from '83, but in reverse. Savage hits Honky with the megaphone and then hits him and then falls into the ring to get counted out. Instead of the reverse, which was Morocco getting headbutted and then falls out of the cage, they kind of use the same logic just in reverse.
Yeah,
kind of a weak finish. You're right, and I think you're right, JR. I've seen. I don't want to say, oh, I've seen enough of them. But, yeah, I mean, unless Savage wins the belt back, it's time to move on to something else.
Kind of right, yeah, I'm not sick of them as a matches, but I do think they get just a touch formulaic, and I do think just neither guy is benefiting at this point. Like, I think both guys kind of need to start getting wins, and they've kind of done this now, so I think it benefits both to get them away from each other.
Yeah, and I think, again, to Savage, and Honky, again, great match for his own right. But, yeah, the whole chasing Liz and all that, it's getting now, later on, when Fink announces the Day After Christmas card, we'll get into that card, because there's something obviously pertaining to these guys. Savage is just being trusted more and more. I mean, obviously there was a big match later in the card that you could consider a co-main event, but Savage is getting trusted more and more to be able to carry the mid-show main events now here at the Garden. And that I think that speaks volumes about his future and what he, you know, what's in store for him in the company, because obviously Vince and the bookers have a lot of faith in him, Kel. Another great match, 3.5 for me, but I agree with JR that it's time to kind of push this along.
Yeah, I enjoyed this one too. It's funny though, like there was really good heat for this, but the match they had a couple months ago, the last show I did with you guys, it was a non-title match, and the heat for that was a lot greater. And in this match, where conceivably they could see a title change, the heat, you know, they didn't seem to be buying that Savage was going to win, and you know, he didn't. And then maybe, you know, the fans kind of saw that writing on the wall too, that he wasn't going to win. I don't know. But you just didn't feel like they were anticipating a title change. You didn't feel that kind of heat. But no, it was still good. Of course, Savage is awesome. Honky was great at this time. I love how they always keep the psychology of Honky only being able to get an advantage if Hart helps him.
Right.
You know, basically to keep the story going that he's really not a good wrestler. He fluked into the Intercontinental title, and he shouldn't be, you know, getting the advantage on a wrestler by any fair means, because he's nowhere near the caliber of wrestler that the guys he's facing, and he's a fraud. So I love that they keep that going. Yeah, it was really good. But and the finish, yeah, I like your comparison to the Morocco snooker cage match, Scott. That I didn't think of that, but no, it works. But that one's a tough one to pull off to leave the crowd satisfied. You got immediate bullshit chance, loud bullshit chance at the finish, but then they let the crowd go home happy, kind of giving a big, you know, blow off moment in a way, because Savage does get to smash Honky with the Kadar, even though it was, you know, barely visible to a lot of the fans, I think, because he hit him just before they got to the back. But still, you know, that was the closest to a quote win that Savage was going to get in this feud, because he wasn't going to get the belt back and he wasn't going to lose any matches. So this was a tough one to book, this feud, for sure, because nobody was going to get a definitive win. But it's still not over. I went 3 stars on it, you know, very good, but just unsatisfying, though, at the same time.
I got to say quickly, about the guitar shot. I love that, because that kind of came out of nowhere. I didn't expect Honky,
yeah,
I didn't expect Savage,
yeah,
to chase him down the aisle and fucking crack him with the guitar. That came out of nowhere. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
Very unsavage-like. I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
So, all right, with that excellent midpoint, why don't we take a break? Not bad so far, JR. Well, Pete's not here, so the show's really good.
Yeah. The curse of Shearmarker.
Yeah. But no, good show so far, right?
Yeah, no, it's been a fun one. I mean, obviously more so for me, because I think I was a bit higher in some of these matches than you guys. Savage Honky, I want to say WWF was kind of lucky that the girls did what they did on this show, because like if this was the anchor match, it definitely was a bit disappointing from what we've seen in the past. They lucked out that this didn't have to carry the show, because I don't know if I feel like they're just kind of running out of things a little bit, Savage and Honky, to do.
Mm. Yeah. Kel, not bad so far?
No, pretty good. Went by fast the first half. The only match I really didn't like, well, the opener was a dud, but it was short, was the Killer Bees Bolsheviks match. That was quite lengthy. But other than that, the women's match is an all-time great women's WWF match. So, yeah, can't complain about that.
Well, when we return, 3 more matches, including our 3rd title match of the evening, involving, as we mentioned earlier, our new World Tag Team Champions and a couple of debuts for the Garden, including one of JR's favorites of all time. That got me.
Yes.
And just when you think she's at one in the world, your heart gets stolen by some massive little girl, and then you know you better make up your mind. Pick up on one and leave the other behind. It's not often easy and not often kind. Did you ever have to make up your mind?
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, this is Ed Banger Thrasher, and you're listening to what the fuck is it? The Place to Be podcast, or you better not miss it because I'm on it.
We're back talking the November 87 Madison Square Garden House Show. And of course, joining us as always, not as always, but joining me as always, Scott Criscolo. Joining us is our third man in the booth, and that is Mr. Kelly Nelson. Kelly, thanks for being here as always. And of course, become a good friend of ours. And you know, Scott, it was just a couple years ago we saw Creed in the theaters. Did you see the Instagram picture out today about the new...
Pumped.
Yeah, you fired up.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Your Rocky Yvonne's guy, Kelly?
Yvonne Jr. Pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yep. If you remember, Scott, we saw that with our buddy Jim way back in the day. Hopefully, well, maybe he'll join us again. I sent him the picture. He's pretty fired up, and if he shows. And that was, of course, did you know that Jim's nickname back in the day was Phony? Were you aware of that?
I was.
Of course, we'd always sing to him Phony Phony, like the song Money Money that you hear playing under us here tonight. That is the number one song in the nation this week in 1987. And here to talk about that in the Pop Culture Corner, Mr. Scott Criscolo.
Thank you, JR. Phony and Phony is fun. Money Money is your number one song. Of course, it is a remake of a song from the 60s. It might even be the 50s. Mr. Billy Idol, your number one. Of course, this list came out the previous Saturday, November 21st. 1987. Number two, from the great Dirty Dancing soundtrack. Good old Bill Medley, Jennifer Warrens. I've had the time of my life. I think you and Jeff should practice those moves, Jer. At number three.
How do you know we haven't?
Because you would have recorded it, because you record everything. So.
That's true.
Even your practices. At number three, Ex-Go-Go, Belinda Carlisle, Smoking Hot as Always with Heaven is a Place on Earth. Number four, at the time, smoking hot for us teenagers, the mall queen herself, Tiffany, with I Think We're Alone Now. Number five, the boss, who's not hot at all, Bruce Springsteen with Brilliant Disguise. Number six, Breakout by Swing Out Sister. Some people may not relate or may not correlate the artist with the song, but that's the Breakout. Dun, 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 dun. You may not remember the name of the artist, but anyway. That was number six. Little Richard Marx at number seven. Should've Known Better. Good song. Number eight, Little Lies by Fleetwood Mac. Number nine, I've Been in Love Before by The Cutting Crew. Another good song. And number 10, from his awesome album, Faith, the title track, Faith, by George Michael. One of my favorite albums at that time. So there's your top 10 for the week of November 21st, 1987. And yes, Billy Idol's Monet Monet is number one.
Best use of Think We're Alone Now was Full House. When they're singing and Danny comes home and they're like, we're not alone now.
Yes.
Which is them being up late.
Yes, I do remember that. Great song by Tiffany. All right. And a great Goldbergs episode involving Tiffany as well. I forgot what season it was. I think it was season three.
And My Dreams featuring Tiffany Amber Thiessen.
That too. Yes. All right. Movies, JR. Been a while since you've had to dig for anything good. But a bevy of movies came out on Friday, November 20th.
Okay.
Here we go. At number five, this is an animated movie, probably not much for you to think of, but I know it's animated, making $3.26 million. It is, I imagine, a sequel, Pinocchio and the Emperor of the Night.
Okay.
I'm guessing it's a Disney sequel.
I guess so. And this actually went to theaters, huh?
I guess so, yeah.
The poster looks like it's like a My Little Pony movie or something. A bumblebee named Lieutenant Grumblebee is woken from a sleep by the this already sounds stupid by the arrival of a large sinister looking ship. A man named Puppetino remarks that this is an ideal spot for the carnival. Stakes and ropes fly from the ship and a circus tent forms. Grumblebee hastily leaves the area. A year after being made human by the good fairy, Pinocchio celebrates his first birthday. I feel like we've talked about this before, or have I watched it, read about it somewhere else?
You had to. No.
Grumblebee sounds super familiar, and so does the whole like Pinocchio's year old. Are you sure we didn't talk about this already?
I don't think so. No, it's here.
It sounds familiar to you, Kelly?
Yeah, the Grumblebee part sounds familiar.
Really?
Right?
I don't know. It says it came out November. All right, we can skip it then.
No,
it says it came out November 20th. So.
No, it just sounds familiar for some reason. I'm reading it. I'm like, it sounds real familiar. She brings to life.
I thought Grumblebee was Jim's name when he can get into Picasso's. I thought he called himself Grumblebee.
The good fairy appears, brings to life one of Pinocchio's old carvings, a wooden glowworm, to act as Pinocchio's conscience. He accidentally names it G. Willikers. After the party, Pinocchio offers to deliver a jewel box to the mayor for Geppetto. And the nonsense goes on and on. Tom Bosley is Geppetto. Ed Asner as Scalawag the Raccoon. James Earl Jones is the Emperor. Ricky Lee Jones as the Fairy Godmother. Don Knotts is G. Willikers. William Wyndham is Puppetino.
Puppetino.
Jonathan Harris is Lieutenant Grumblebee.
Jim's other alias, Puppetino. All right.
Grumblebee
so,
sounds
at number
so
four,
familiar.
At number four, a comedy. Actually, a sequel to a pretty awesome movie. That came out a few years earlier. It made $7.88 million. It is Teen Wolf 2.
Starring the return of Grumblebee.
There we go. Teen Wolf 2.
Teen Wolf 2.
T-O-O.
Of course.
Yes, it was. Teen Wolf T-O-O. You're right.
Todd Howard, the cousin of Scott Howard, has been accepted to Hamilton University at a full athletic scholarship on the recommendation of Coach Bobby Finstock, who was Scott's basketball coach at Beacontown High. Finstock's hope is that Todd has the family genes to become a werewolf and turn Finstock's newly struggling boxing team into championship contenders. Having never much been very good at sports, and because he's more interested in being a veterinarian, Todd is certain that Finstock has the wrong guy. Starring, of course, Jason Bateman as Todd Howard, Kim Darby, John Astin, Paul Sand as Bobby Finstock. That's about it for names.
They recast Bobby Finstock. The guy that played him in the first movie was awesome. I'm trying to remember. He goes, there's three things you live in life. Do you remember, Cal? I can't think of the first one. The second one is never trust a guy who has the same first name as a city, and never trust a woman who has a tattoo of a dagger on her body. If you follow those rules, everything else is cream cheese. That's the great Bobby Finstock, the Finstock quote in the first one. But and it wasn't Paul Sand. It was some other dude.
Never trust a guy with a hyphenated name. That's one of my personal ones.
Yes.
Jay Tarsus was Coach Bobby Finstock in the original.
Yes. But the minute it was Scott Howard's relative, you think, oh, this is going to suck. Yeah. You know. But Jason Bateman was fine. But, of course, Scott Howard was Michael J. Fox, and the first Teen Wolf was pretty awesome. Okay, the third rated movie that weekend made $14 million, a horror movie titled Flowers in the Attic. Ooh, Flowers in the Attic.
Flowers for Algernon.
This is probably not as deep as Flowers for Algernon.
After the sudden death of their father, four children, teenagers Chris and Kathy and five-year-old twins Corey and Carrie, find themselves penniless and forced to travel with their mother Corinne to live with their wealthy parents. Corinne informs her children there's been tension between herself and parents for many years, does not elaborate, simply said they had cut her out of their lives for something she did that disapproved them. Corinne's mother Olivia is a religious fanatic, takes her daughter and children to the home. Through the harsh condition, the children must be sequestered away in a locked room, so Malcolm, who's dying, will never know of their existence. There's a lot more to it than that that I don't care about. Starring Christy Swanson, Jeb Stuart Adams, Victoria Tennant, Louise Fletcher, Nathan Davis. No one else, really.
Wow. I wonder how old Christy Swanson was. 1987?
Teenager. She 13, was born in 1969, so.
She 18. Was 18. Okay. Yeah. There you go. All right. The number two movie of the weekend made $28.86 million, a drama entitled Nuts. Go ahead, insert anything you want there. And it's a drama. That makes it even better.
Nuts. When call girl Claudia Draper kills client Alan Green in self-defense, her mother Rose and stepfather Arthur attempt to have her declared mentally incompetent by Dr. Herbert Morrison to avoid a public scandal. Claudia knows that. If her parents succeed, she'll be remanded to the mental institution indefinitely, so she's determined to prove she's sane enough to stand trial. Starring Barbara Streisand, Richard Dreyfuss, Maureen Stapleton, Carl Malden, Leslie Nielsen, William Prince, Dakin Matthews. Not bad. Not a bad little cast there.
No. Obviously a highly thought of movie. Carl Malden and Barbara Streisand, same nose length. look roughly the same. So obviously a movie that probably did very well. However, this movie I think did pretty well at the Oscars that following spring. It was the number one movie of the weekend. It made $43.98 million. A drama entitled
Nuts 2. The Search for Nuts.
search Nuts 2. Scott Howard's cousin.
No. Jason Bateman stars in Nuts 2.
the movie is called The Last Emperor.
Yeah. Isn't that the Grumblebee?
Yes, that's the Grumblebee. Yes, The Last Emperor is Puppetino.
In 1950, P has been kept in custody for 5 years since the Red Army captured him during the Soviet Union entry into the Pacific War and recent established People's Republic of China. He arrives as a political prisoner and war criminal. Soon after his arrival, he attempts suicide, was quickly revived and told he must stand trial. 42 years earlier, a toddler is summoned to Forbidden City by dying Empress Dowager Cixi. After telling him that the previous emperor... this is too much. Starring John Lone, Joan Chen, Peter O'Toole, Victor Wong, Rick Young... nobody else. Henry O. Godwin as Lord Chamberlain.
That's awesome. Anyway, I know that I'm pretty sure that did very well at the Oscars the following spring, that movie. So.
Yeah, it won Best Picture.
There you go.
It's a really good movie. It's directed by Bernardo Bertolucci, who was a pretty accomplished Italian director.
Absolutely was. Yep. Nuts didn't win. Nuts.
Nuts.
All right. From nuts to balls. Because it is time to take the field.
Kelly's been mailing his picks in to Scott's address. It's like fantasy, right? In 1987, you had to mail the rosters in, so that's been Kelly.
Pony Express. JR, what are the standings right now?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see. All right. So Kelly has 25. I have 28.
All right, JR.
Is that right, Mr. Nelson? Kelly, I check out to you.
Yeah, I gained one on you last.
Okay. Peter Winston has eight. So there you go. Yeah. Landy has nine.
All right. So we are in week 11 of the 1987 NFL season. Of course, we are past the strike. The regular guys are back. So this might be your last shot, Kel, because I'm pretty sure you're not back till well after the season's over. So you may get one shot. It depends when the regular season ends.
Well, he can keep mailing his in.
Yeah. No, but I'm saying by the time our, because remember we have two more shows this week,
right.
So
yeah.
it's three episodes away before we get to the next thing. Okay. So we'll see. Depends when that December house show, if the regular season's over or not. Anyway, all right, here we go.
You're fucked, Kelly, is what he's saying. So good luck.
Yeah, you might be deep shit here. But actually, you know what, Kel? I'm going to reverse it. I'm going to reverse it and let you go first this time. So Kel, we begin.
That doesn't help him.
that
makes it worse.
That's totally fair.
I don't know.
it hurts him. I can just keep picking the same fucking teams. I'm not gonna, because I'm a real man, but I could.
Yeah. Yeah, we should have Kelly go second every time. No. Kel, let's go to the Homer Dome in Minneapolis. The Vikings hosting the Atlanta Falcons.
Vikes.
Vikings hosting the Falcons. Yeah, I'll go Minnesota.
Vikings win 24-13. All right, let's go to Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City. The Chiefs, JR, hosting Green Bay. A rematch of Super Bowl I.
Chiefs at home, babe.
Yeah, I'll go with KC, too.
Oh! Packers win big, 23-3.
Suck, Kelly. That was your chance.
That was your chance, Kel. I was hoping you'd say the Packers. You did not. Mm. Let's go to the Big Sombrero in Tampa, Kel. The Bucks hosting the 49ers.
49ers.
Yeah, Niners.
Yes. Joe Montana throws for 304. Niners win 24-10. Let's go to Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati. The Bengals hosting the Pittsburgh Steelers, JR.
I'll go with the Steelers on the road in that one.
I'll take the Bengals.
Boomer Esiason throws for 409 yards. The Steelers win
30-17.
Yes! I think you're fucked now, Kel. Let's go to Soldier Field in Chicago. The Bears hosting the Detroit Lions, Kel.
That Bears.
Yep.
Yes, Bears win 30-10. All right, let's go to the vet, that fucking toilet. And JR, the Eagles hosting the St. Louis Cardinals.
E-A-G-L-E-S, Eagles!
Yes. Yeah, I got to take the Eagles, baby.
You shouldn't have. You fucking suck. Randall Cunningham throws for 272, but the Cardinals win 31-19.
Oh, Jesus.
Let's go to the Astrodome in Houston. Who's next here? Kel. The Oilers hosting the Cleveland Browns.
Oilers.
Yeah, Oilers at home.
Yeah. You do realize the Browns made it to the AFC Championship, you schmucks. They beat the Oilers 40-7.
So they didn't go undefeated.
Well, no, but they're better than Houston. Damn it, Kel. I'm trying to lead you along here. All right, now. Let us go to the Giant Stadium in the Meadowlands, where your JR, J-E-T-S, Jets, host the Buffalo Bills.
Well, the Jets fucked me last week. That was the one Kelly gained on me, so I'm going to go with the Bills on the road.
I'll take the Jets, then. Jets.
That was terrible. Bills win 17-14. See, he played mind games with you. All right. Let's go to Foxborough, where the New England Patriots host the Indianapolis Colts. Let's see, 2-4, who's up?
Kelly.
Kel.
It doesn't really matter anymore. The Patriots.
Yeah, I'll go Pats.
Pats in a shutout, 24-0. All right, let us go to the, where you're going to be in a couple months, JR, the Metrodome in the Superdome. I almost pulled a Hogan. Superdome in New Orleans, the Giants and the New Orleans Saints.
Giants on the road.
I'll go with the Saints. Yeah.
Saints win 23-14.
Took the risk. Paid
back
off.
In it, baby.
All right. Let us go to the Kingdome in Seattle. The Seahawks host the San Diego Chargers. JR. Kel.
Seahawks.
Yeah. Seattle at home.
Seattle wins big 34-3. Let's go to the Mausoleum in Los Angeles. The Raiders hosting the Denver Broncos.
Yeah, I'll take the Raiders in the black hole.
Okay.
Broncos. I'll go with the Broncos.
John Elway throws for 298. Broncos win 23-17. Let's go to Texas Stadium in Irving, the hole in the roof, the Cowboys hosting the Miami Dolphins. Kel?
Dolphins.
Yeah, Miami. Fuck the Cowboys. They suck.
Yes, they do suck. Dolphins win 20-14. Finally, Monday night at RFK, the Redskins host the LA Rams, JR.
Skins.
Yeah, I got to go with the Skins, too.
Doug Williams throws for 308 yards, but the Rams win 30-26.
Ooh. All right, so the tally right now, that is, what, 26-33 for Kelly, and 10-19-20-36 for me. Peter Winston.
Push. Yeah.
All right. Well, guess what? I looked ahead. You will get one more shot, Kel, because week 16 is the same weekend as that December house show.
Ooh.
So you get one more shot. We'll get
closing
one more
it
shot.
Out.
All right. I'll be ready.
You do get one more shot. Final week of the regular season. All right. Quickly, let's go to the NBA. As the NBA season began a couple weeks earlier, the Los Angeles Lakers are your defending world champions. There were seven games on this night. One game went into double overtime. The Clippers beat Golden State 123-120. The highest scorer on this night was the X-Man. Xavier McDaniel had 34, and the Supersonics blew out the Lakers in Seattle 103-85. And finally, the NHL season, NHL scores, just one. And none of our teams were in action. The Islanders lost to the Maple Leafs at Nassau Coliseum 4-3. Quick check of the standings briefly. Our Bruins, JR, second place with 28 points in the Adams division. The Whalers are in last. No shock there. And the Flames with 25 points, 1 point behind the world champion Edmonton Oilers. And that is your pop culture report. Back to the garden. What do we got, JR?
All right. Up next, what do we got going on? Is a match between Jake the Snake Roberts taking on Dangerous Danny Davis. Interesting cooldown match here. Jake finally back in MSG after a long layoff due to his injury issues. Find a way to integrate him back. Jake and Damian get a good pop. Al warns that it could be underestimating Danny, as many have. Al notes that Jimmy Hart's not here, says Danny's a great amateur wrestler and has learned a lot about the pro game from Jimmy and the Hart Foundation. Gets some feeling out and stalling before getting a lockup. Jake looks huge in there with Danny. Danny keeps dodging and stalling as Nick says any wrestlers that lean on the fans are fools. Jake finally catches Davis and works the arm in a funny series, yanking Davis up and down off his knees, flipping him up and over. Davis ends up face-to-face with the sack of holding Damian, of course, and then quickly slides out of the ring. Davis returns, gets slammed, and slides back out again, but this time Jake follows and fucks with him on the floor. Back inside, Davis catches Jake with a few shots, rattles him with a knee lift for two. Davis gets some strike offense, but Jake makes a quick comeback, gets the short arm clothesline and the DDT for the win, which happened real fast. Jake unleashes Damian after the bell, and the snake just lays on Davis for an uncomfortably long time. Jimmy eventually shows up to help Davis wake up, but this was nothing. Lots of stalling and stooging until the snap finish. Good to see Jake back, though. He's still super over. Davis quickly wearing out his welcome here in the WWF at this point. I went half a star just for the heat and for Jake's antics, but nothing else doing. I don't remember who's up next. Kelly, you? Is it your turn?
Sure.
Yeah, match six, so it's your turn, Cal. Good.
Yeah, Stallorama by Davis to start, and pretty much all his heat is gone from earlier in the year. I mean, remember how hot a heel he was at the beginning of 1987.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jimmy Hart's not even accompanying him to the ring.
He's pretty much just done.
And Hart was obviously there, so geez. Yeah, he's just a JTTS now. But Jake needed some fodder for his return. And yeah, he got it. But no, not much of a match. I loved how just as soon as Jake gets on offense, the crowd starts chanting DDT. They really love that move. That move's super over. Jake's super over. And bam, Davis gets nailed with DDT, and it's all over. Yeah, one star for me.
So how long was Jake even, like, working? When did he start getting back in the ring? Because, I mean, we haven't seen him here in forever. Like, I feel like since almost Mania time, right?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It was a long suspension.
No, was this, this was the injury, wasn't it?
I think it was a combination of the suspension and an injury.
No, he definitely got pitched. He definitely got pitched.
Yeah, in the environment after the Duggan Sheik scandal, Jake was one of the guys who got busted for coke. But he was also legit hurt at the time, too.
Right.
So,
well, let's see. He's on TV in July, and then he gets subbed again in July. So, I don't know. It's kind of all over the place. It's like back and forth. But we have not seen him in MSG in quite a while.
Yeah.
I'm going to see when the last time we had him here was.
Yeah, I'm looking ahead to May. He's right. Let's see. Sub for Jake.
We haven't seen him in – so we last saw him at Science Man event in May when he lost to Kamala. WrestleMania 3 before that, Science Man. We haven't seen him here since he fought Bundy in February.
He's still being subbed in June.
Yeah, it's back and forth from there. It's like July and August. He's like on, off, on, off.
Yeah.
Looks like he comes back probably in like – well, he wrestles on a challenge taping in August. Yeah, he's back in August.
Because at the time watching this, you know, as it was happening, it didn't seem like he was really gone. Or I don't remember thinking that he was gone because I think they were able to space out his TV appearances anyway. But yeah, he was definitely off the major shows for this whole time.
Yeah, he's wrestling through August, but I'm curious why he was subbed in October. Yeah, he's wrestling all tapings in August, and he's saying, "Yeah, no, defeated Jake Bundy, defeated Jake." Only started jobbing a little bit. A non-tournament match. He fought Honky in Providence in September, in the King of the Ring on the King of the Ring show as the tournament. Oh, what's this sub for? No, he starts getting subbed out in September. Yep,
that would be the injury, I guess.
Yeah.
So the injury wasn't the neck thing earlier in the year? I guess not.
I think he did hurt his neck early in the year, but he didn't take any time off for it until it got like way too bad for him to work. You know how they were back then.
Yeah.
So the original time.
What do you think he was using to numb the pain? Which is probably why he got pinched.
You're right. Yeah. He was starting to get into the drugs, got pinched for that, came back, and then the neck injury was too much to fight through, and he comes back here. So, all right, give us your thoughts, Scott.
All right. I give it a 1.5. It's a nothing.
1.5. Jesus. All right. I don't feel as bad now about my earlier comments.
The next match is the same thing. I thought it was all right. I mean, it wasn't anything horrendous. It was decent. I mean, Danny Davis is a serviceable guy. He's a guy that you'll now see. I mean, clearly with the Hearts no longer champions, you know, his usefulness is pretty much over. So now he's just some dude. And he's a fine guy to go in and, you know, put some faces over. And he does here. Jake needed the win to kind of get his groove back. But it was fine. I'm happy giving it a 1.5 just for those purposes, that it looked fine. And, you know, Jake's back in the groove. They sell the fucking fact that Dan – and then Jimmy runs out at the end. Mm. So it's like a – you know, and even Bachwick is like, yeah, where the hell was he? You know, it's like they was even selling the fact that Jimmy didn't give a shit. That's pretty funny. But, nothing going on here. But serviceable match.
All right. Let's get to our next one then. This is a pretty loaded card when you look at this one. There's a lot going on here. A lot of big matches. A big tag title rematch between the Strike Force and Heart Foundation. Strike Force, of course, have recently upset the Hearts to take the gold just months after forming as a team. Good heat for the Hearts to look both pissed and focused. Strike Force gets a huge pop as they jog out to Girls in Cards with the new titles around their waists. Gets some stalling to open as the announcers break down the Hearts. Brett and Martel open up and trade off some basic holds. Nick puts over Jimmy Hart for being so active as Brett starts to work over Martel in the corner. Martel comes back with some arm drags that sends Brett to the floor. He returns and tags Anvil. Tito comes in as well, and they trade off some standing holds until Tito goes to a side headlock and grinds away as Gorilla says he's dropped 10 to 12 pounds. Martel comes in and hooks a headlock as well as Anvil comes over and tags Brett. Gets a roll-up, hooks the tights for two. Martel goes back to the headlock as Nick talks about how weary Strikeforce must be of a team like the Hearts. Tito locks in a chancery and then gets a small package for two. Anvil tags in and decks Tito in the gut, powers him to the mat with strikes. Anvil works a chinlock as Gorilla predicts that Jimmy's Chargers will all lose their titles very soon. Anvil slams Tito but misses an elbow, but Brett tags and catches Chico before he can tag. Brett works over Tito for a moment, and before he tags Martel, who comes in and cleans house as he hits the ropes. Anvil hooks the ropes and he tumbles hard to the floor. Anvil meets him out there and sends him into the barricade and shoves him back inside. The Hearts really start to dig in, quick tagging and double teaming like they do so well. Anvil gets Martel in a bear hug and continues to punish the midsection. The Hearts blind tag behind the ref and Brett keeps hammering away. Tags in Anvil, slams Martel hard to the mat. Brett comes back in and buries an elbow off the middle rope for two. Martel blocks a backdrop and gets a roll-up for two, but the Hearts maintain control and slug away. Martel tries to fire out of the corner and eventually knocks Brett down to the floor and tags Tito. It comes in hot and mows down Anvil with a forearm for two. Brett accidentally drills Anvil and Strikeforce follows with a double clothesline. Martel twists Anvil into a Boston Crab, but Brett breaks it up. Things break down, and everyone starts to brawl, and Martel gets the Crab again, but Jimmy throws Brett the megaphone, and he hits Martel with it. Anvil covers, but the ref saw it and calls for the DQ. The Hearts beat the piss out of Strikeforce after the announcement, as Girls in Cars plays, but Tito eventually fends them off. This took some time to get cranking. Once it hit the Martel Heat segment, it picked up nicely. There was some good pacing in here. The Hearts are masterful at controlling the Heat segments. Strikeforce continues to be hot. Good call to keep the belts on them. Protects the Hearts as well at the DQ. Good anchor match, I thought, but again, a step behind some of the recent tag stuff we've seen with Strikeforce and the Hearts. I went 3 stars on this, Scott.
I went 3.5. So you were saying earlier about how I was under I was undergrading, and now I'm overgrading. But your match time 18-18. This match is fantastic. I tell you something. There has been no better opportunity for a guy to come back from being kind of in the middle of nowhere to being red hot than Tito. Like you said, Kel, Tito kind of went from, you know, the middle of nowhere to now suddenly one half of the tag champs. Him and Martel look awesome together. Tito looks so rejuvenated with the headband and the white tights and the white jacket, and even more than Martel. I mean, Tito looks like he's 5 years younger than he actually is, you know. They look awesome. And what I loved about this match is that it's been a long time. It's been over a year, obviously, since the Hearts have had to wrestle kind of defensively and almost desperate. So I've kind of I really enjoyed seeing it wrestle differently for them, that now they're the ones back to chasing. And I thought it was a great back and forth. I didn't totally get the ending. I kind of thought Strikeforce should have won clean. But to kind of, you know, help solidify them as champions instead of the wonky ending, but whatever. I mean, I don't know if protecting the Hearts really mattered at this point, but that's fine. Overall, the match, the intensity of the match was great. I thought everybody looked good. A lot of hot spots. And Strikeforce is just really, really looking good, and I think they've really done a nice job rejuvenating the division after all the work they did with the Islanders. They just look really refreshed, particularly Tito, big time. So 3.5 stars for me, Kel, for two, again, because Strikeforce just looks so fresh and new and exciting, and the Hearts wrestle differently for the first time in a while. They haven't had to wrestle really defensively since before they beat the Bulldogs, and it was a great change of pace. Fantastic match.
Yeah, I agree. I went 3.5, too. I love both teams. Strikeforce are so great at this time. Yeah, like you said, Scott, Tito's rejuvenated. Martel was just having a really great year in 1987. Great decision putting them together. And yeah, the Hearts, they've been a solid team for a couple of years, and they've had a great 1987 as well. So yeah, just great work by both teams. Great face and peril on Martel. And that got the crowd really into it. Because, yeah, the match started a little slow, but it was like a feeling out process, too. And that was fine. And, yeah, Martel was really a star in this one. Great bump to the outside to get the heat started on him. And then Tito, the hot tag to Tito, great house of fire. The flying forearm he gave Anvil was awesome. He looked like he really smacked him with it. Mm-hmm. And my one criticism for this is the finish was just totally fucked up. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know what was going on. The officiating throughout the show was pretty poor tonight. Too many the ref missed it spots. It was just one every match had this, mm-hmm. One of those spots. But this one, the ref missed the megaphone shot to Martel, or it looked like he missed it because he was having this heated argument with Tito.
And then he calls the bell.
Yeah, that continued after the bell. Yeah, and he called for the bell, and it seemed like I was thinking, now, is he going to DQ Tito? Because Tito just was being so stubborn, and just because he continues the argument after the bell with Tito. But no, apparently he did see the megaphone shot, even though clearly he didn't. So the whole finish was a mess. I mean, I guess they were going to keep this going for a bit. The Hearts had just lost the belts, didn't want to give them another loss right away, have them draw on the road, because they do string this into 1988 with mm-hmm. these two teams mm-hmm. going at it. But no, still, I mean, really good match. And yeah, just with a messy finish. But that's the only thing that really marred it.
Sometimes a messy finish isn't a good thing, guys.
Not in wrestling.
Not that kind of wrestling. Okay, so yeah, pretty good match there. And our tag team champion is still Strikeforce. Let's move on to our next match featuring another debut. Lots going on here in November of 87. Is Theodore Marvin DiBiase Sr., born on January 18, 1954, in Miami, Florida, the biological son of wrestlers Helen Nevins and Ted Wills, entertainer and singer, adopted son of wrestler Iron Mike DiBiase, adopted father died of a heart attack in the ring, of course, when Ted was 15. Seven-time NWA World Champion Harley Race rushed to the ring to perform CPR but was unable to save Mike's life. His mother went to depression and alcoholism, and DiBiase moved to Willcox, Arizona with his grandparents, attended Creighton Preparatory High School, attended West Texas State University on a football scholarship, became a member of the Alpha Tau Omega fraternity, dropped out of college his senior year, and decided to get into professional wrestling, trained by Dory Funk Jr. and Terry Funk, made his debut as a referee June 1974, went to Mid-South with Bill Watts, promoted as the son of Iron Mike in 1975, stayed there for 4 years, very short stint with Vince Sr.'s WWWF in 1979, was it WWF by then? I don't know, 1979. When did that change happen?
I think it changed that year.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So as it was being changed. Awarded the short-lived North American Championship, becoming the title's first champion in June 1979, lost out to Pat Patterson and unified the title with the fictional South American Championship, which became the first ever IC title. One legendary angle at DiBiase enduring four pile drivers administered in the WTBS studios by Fabulous Freebirds before tag team partner Tommy Wildfire Rich threw in the towel. Rich and DiBiase later feuded, leading to a loser leaves town match where DiBiase won. Instead of Rich leaving the area, donned a mask calling himself Mr. R. The feud culminated in a match between Mr. R and DiBiase, where Rich appeared from backstage and distracted DiBiase. Mr. R rolled him up to get the win and unmasked Brad Armstrong. In the early to mid-80s, DiBiase was in various angles in various territories with the likes of Ric Flair, best known from this point in Mid-South, returned with the likes of Bob Roop, Paul Orndorff, Dick Murdoch, the Fabulous Freebirds, One Man Gang, turned heel against the Junkyard Dog, formed a group called the Rat Pack with Jim Duggan and Matt Bourne. They ran that for months. Aligned with Skandor Akbar, called a wrist in the group, namely Duggan. The two would feud until DiBiase lost to lose the Leafs town match. Of course, they had some tremendous fights. Check those out. He also held various titles and made frequent trips to All Japan Pro Wrestling, his eventual departure from Mid-South, which is now UWF. His matches usually ended with the use of a loaded black glove, which he pulled from his tights to knock out his opponents. He was locked in talks with the NWA in 1987 during the acquisition of UWF by Jim Crockett, but then he received an offer from the WWF and was convinced to go there due to the fact that he would not be told his gimmick until after he agreed. He signed up despite that under the promise it was something that would receive a serious push. Pat Patterson has legendarily told DiBiase that if Vince McMahon were to go wrestle, it would be the gimmick he'd want to give himself. That hooked DiBiase in, made his return on May 15th at a house show in Houston, came out to the ring to announce those in attendance. It was only fitting he was now competing in the WWF. Moments later, One Man Gang and Slick came out. The ref had to force DiBiase to leave before a confrontation. At the next house show on June 7th, DiBiase had his first match and a loss to the One Man Gang. He then tag-teamed with Sam Houston on June 26th against Gang and Ron Bass. Toward the end of the match, DiBiase turned on and attacked Houston after Houston missed a dropkick on Bass, leaving him to get double-teamed and pinned. His actions then during the match served to effectively turn DiBiase heel right before the on-screen debut of his new gimmick, the Million Dollar Man, with lots of vignettes. We'll see a few of those next week, Scott. He's, of course, accompanied now by Virgil, who's his bodyguard, born Michael Jones, June 13th, 1962, the king of the fuck money, lover of Olive Garden, standout amateur career. Jones started wrestling professionally as Soul Train Jones in the CWA in 1985, feuded with Chick Donovan and Big Bubba, made appearances at ICW, moves to WWF as enhancement talent under the name Luscious Brown, losing a squash to Paul Orndorff in 1986, and reappears here as Virgil, of course, which is a ripoff or a parody of Virgil Runnels, Dusty Rhodes. All comes full circle. Big MSGB here as Ted DiBiase saunters out to the ring with Virgil, talks about maybe purchasing Madison Square Garden, but decides not to because the shitty Knicks and Rangers and all the loser fans convinced him not to do so. Putski jogs out for an interesting match, and that is Ivan Putski's opponent here tonight as his little comeback continues. Nick bags on Putski's height as things get going. DiBiase begs off and stalls. Al says we need to see Ted win this before he'll believe anything about him. Ted bails outside and Putski meets him and hammers away. DiBiase tries to land a boot, but Putski's all over him, hits an atomic drop and a wild flurry of punches. Nick keeps making height jokes at Putski as he hits the hammer, and Ted stumbles to the floor. Ted's bleeding from the mouth. He comes back in, catches Ivan with a beautiful power slam for the win. Nothing here, but a quick pace. The finish was great. I love that power slam. Ted took a beating, but was resilient and ended the match in a blink. Nice debut. Fine role for Ivan putting these guys over. Half star, Kelly. Give me your thoughts on the gimmick and anything about the match.
Well, I mean, the gimmick is legendary. Yeah, I mean, if it was what Vince envisioned for himself, I mean, that's a dream gimmick to be given. And, you know, the story was that to live the gimmick, he had to, you know, ride around in limousines and private jets and all that, which was paid for entirely by Vince and the WWF. So, and on top of that, you're pushed as the top heel in the WWF. So just one of the great circumstances for a wrestler to find himself in at that time. And as we'll see, it's a long-standing gimmick, and he does incredibly well with the character. But here, he's just starting. This is like the Ultimate Warrior. He hasn't really, you know, figured it out yet. The promo that he cuts was all well and good, but, you know, I don't think if you buy MSG, you have to buy the Rangers and the Knicks as well. And I don't think that's how it works.
Well, Dolan owns all three, right? So maybe that's what you're saying.
But anyway, you know, he was working, and this was his return to the Garden after an 8-year absence, because he worked there, of course, in the late 70s. So yeah, he's back, and it's totally different circumstances this time.
I never knew all that stuff in the summer where he started as a face, and then they did the turn. Like, it's kind of a cool way to get him kind of in the go of things, but wait until the gimmick debuted on TV. I thought that was kind of shrewd.
Oh, totally. And again, going back to my memories of watching it at the time, yeah, I remember all the vignettes, and it was week after week. And yeah, well, I mean, my friends and myself, we hated him by the time he got on TV, because he was portrayed as such a scumbag in the vignettes. And it's funny, he's going against Putski, a guy who was in the WWF in 1979 when he was last there. For his debut or his re-debut at MSG. I totally don't remember Putski being around the WWF at this time. And God, a bronzed midget is what he is here. You never think, or at least I don't really think of DiBiase as a huge, tall guy. But
right.
Man, he towers over Putski. And I hate Putski. He's... For me, Parv hated Strongbow, and for me, I hated Putski as my like late 70s WWF guy. I just can't stand him. The power slam was awesome, but so that's why I give it half star instead of a dud. It was a one that was the only offensive move that got on him. It's hilarious, but yeah, crazy. Half star.
I gave this a dud. No knock on Ted, because I've watched plenty of, I think we've all watched plenty of Ted, and Ted's awesome. Putski's just atrocious. And he really does look like a midget. It's really sad. he really does look like a midget. I mean, this is all about Ted. There's nothing more to say. It's pretty much about DiBiase and the fucking awesome gimmick and the awesome. And what sucks is that's like one of the best tuxedo. I mean, we talk about aesthetics a lot with his tuxedo outfits. The black and purple is like one of the coolest, and then we never really see it much. That one and the green one are always the two cool ones, and the occasional white, but he doesn't do white for a few years. This is all just about him. What's funny is Graham puts around 3 minutes, and I timed it today, and it was exactly 3 minutes. I don't know why he just didn't put exactly 3 minutes. Pretty funny. But there's nothing more. Putski's doing what he's meant to do, which is put people over. All right, right. This isn't 1975 anymore. No one gives
a
shit.
He's still eating
Roy
a ton of offense, though. I mean, he's along with the steroids. He's eating.
Yeah, I know.
But he's in the spray tan. But he. Yeah.
But anyway, that's all it was. It was just meant to get DiBiase ready for his next big thing. So that was it.
All right, our final match of the evening features yet another debut, and that is the MSG debut of Scott Charles Bigelow, otherwise known as Bam Bam Bigelow, born September 1st in Asbury Park, New Jersey, quit the town there. After training in Larry Sharpe's Monster Factory in New Jersey, Bigelow debuted as an athletic and agile monster heel in the Memphis territory, Jerry Lawler and Jerry Jarrett, in the summer of 1986. Billed as the Beast from the of the East and referred to as the Bammer by announcer Lance Russell, Bigelow slowly established as an unstoppable force who challenged then-champion Jerry Lawler. He was featured in an article in September 15, 1986, issue of Sports Illustrated. In early 1987, Bigelow wrestled to the CWA, teaming with Jerry Lawler to feud with Austin Idol and Tommy Rich. Around the same time, Bigelow worked a brief stint in World Class with a Russian gimmick known as Crusher Yurkov, yurking off in the soup. In May 1987, he signed with World Wrestling Federation, making his debut on May 28th in Allentown, Pennsylvania, defeated C.V. Offey. Much like the recently signed Dingo Warrior, Bigelow remained off TV until the fall, working just house shows for the summer. Storyline upon his debut was that various heel managers were all vying for his services. The angle was thus called the Battle for Bam Bam. Ron Renzi in the mix there. Bigelow, in the end, wound up a babyface where he denounced all the heel managers, announced his manager was going to be Oliver Humperdinck, and that he would eventually choose Doris over Peg. So here we go. As he takes on another big man, a stalwart veteran, that is King Kong Bundy. Battle of the Bulge to close things out as Bigelow makes his MSG debut. Bundy storms out with Bobby Heenan and MSG mainstay back in town. Bigelow lumbers out to his sax music with Sir Oliver to a big pump. Nick is excited to watch these big giants go at it, especially with how fast they are. Al says Bigelow is shot like a rocket, but he has a big test tonight. Nick makes a ball joke as we lock things up to start. Bundy grabs a side headlock, but Bigelow breaks free. We get a standstill on a pair of shoulder blocks. Bigelow plants him with a third one, does a cartwheel before landing some punches. Bigelow dodges an avalanche, drops a elbow for two. Not a Rob Van Dam elbow, sadly. Bigelow works the arm as Nick says the ring has been moving throughout this whole match due to these big guys. Bundy levels Bigelow with a hard clothesline, drops an elbow for two, and then sends Bigelow flying to the floor. Bammer eventually makes it back in. Bundy hits another hard clothesline. Bundy misses a splash. Bigelow gets one of his own for the win. That's a fun, wild hoss match. Two beasts just going at it, throwing themselves all over the place. Slipknot or not, it just moves so fast and hard. And Bigelow gets a huge win. Really dug that one. It makes Bammer look great, getting the win on Bundy. I really like this. You know, we've talked about hoss matches and whatnot before, but this was just like just two bulls going at it. So I went 2 stars on this one, Scott.
I give this 2 stars, too. Your final match time, a mere 3:22. Again, just a chance to see your boy. I thought both guys moved well still. I tell you something, of all the stuff I've watched on the network since, I guess, in the last, 3-4 years, I feel like I've watched all of Bundy's career, from his World Class stuff to the stuff we watch now. JR, of course, you and I doing the written Vintage Vault refreshes through, 95 Raw. I feel like I've seen all of King Kong Bundy's career. But I got to say, the guy worked his ass off. And for a guy that big, took a lot of great bumps. And he sold a decent amount for Bigelow here. And, Bigelow needed what needed to get done. Obviously, Bundy's another guy like Orndorff who's probably at the end of the line. There's not much left for him to do.
Although you would think that, but there's some stuff going on that we'll see coming up that he's still really effective with.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt. Yeah. His usefulness is not – let's put it this way. His usefulness is not over, but his being kind of a intimidating,
I disagree. I don't know. We'll see. Like, I feel like his size and pedigree keeps him like – not that Orndorff wasn't a great worker, but like Bundy or, kayfabe wrestler. But Bundy, like, because of his size and everything and the fact that he's a heel and can be aligned with Heenan and others, like, I think that keeps him dangerous. Whereas Orndorff is just, with Hogan on top and Savage, it's like, there's only so high you could go as a face at this point. Whereas a guy like Bundy, there's kind of a void at the top of the heel card right now. It's like, Andre's there, but he's not really wrestling. So who else is really honky? You know what I mean? Like, who else is at the top of the heat for the heels at this point? Because even on the face side, you even get Steamboat and Jake, like, lingering around. So, like, Orndorff is, like, automatically, like, seventh in on the depth chart, you know? Whereas on the heel side, it's like, who's really there? So a guy like Bundy actually has a shot to maybe regain some usefulness.
I could see that. No, absolutely. Obviously, they've taken a lot of MSG time to put up, to really work on some new characters and some of the new guys that have come in. He didn't feel, I will say this, Kel, he didn't feel as old and worn out as Orndorff does. So I'll say that, but it's obvious that his, it seems obvious that he's the next one on the list of guys that that might be, you know, next in line to be pushed out the door. However, as we will see over the next, you know, month and a half or so, he is used pretty effectively. But he did a good job here. He did a good job here helping put Bigelow over.
Yeah, I think for Bundy, the feud with Hogan and being in the main event of Mania 2 always, like, gave him, like, this extra cachet that he carried forever, even when he was getting kind of stale. And he came back. He was gone for a bit in 87, I think. Or anyway, they kind of recharged him and re-pushed him at the end of 87. Gets put in the main event of Survivor Series. Gets a Saturday Night's main event match with Hogan. I think two in a row, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe it was just one. Anyway, yeah, so he was kind of back in the mix. And, I mean, yeah, he had a lot of usefulness because of that cachet. And obviously, you know, Bigelow was someone that they had a lot of hope for. And this was a good way to make Bigelow a star because this was a clean win over a previously pretty big main eventer for the company. Yeah, this was good. I went 2 stars as well. It's really short. I think I gave it like maybe an extra half star for actually having a clean finish. We didn't get too many of those tonight. And it was a star-making match, too. So important. Putting it as the very last match on the show maybe diluted its impact a little bit because people were leaving. And I would have placed it more in the middle of the show, too, if they were spotlighting Bigelow.
Right. I would have closed with the Hearts match.
Yeah, that exactly. That would have been a good idea.
Probably.
And they usually went with a tag, hot tag, for the last match, so... It's kind of strange that this one went last. But, yeah, Bigelow, yeah, big debut for him. Haas fight, like you said, good bumps. Bigelow took some good bumps. And, yeah, a fun little sprint. And let's see what happens for Bigelow in the future because he's, right now, he's got the rocket strapped to him, kind of.
Sure does. Just jet up that arena. Rankings. All right, let's do some awards here as we close things out. Interesting show, I think, guys, because this might have been the most like varied we were, I think, in match grades. Like, I think we were kind of all over the place. I don't think we really synced up much at all. So, all right, let's get to our awards. As Bigelow's very well, knows very well, I should say. All right, match of the night here we have, I thought this was an easy call for me anyway. I have the Jumping Bomb Angels versus the Glamour Girls.
I do as well, but you do. When you first think about it, you're like, "Wow, I thought that would have been a gimme." But you're like, "Well, there's a few contenders to give it a run for its money." But it definitely for me was.
I think it's crazy on paper when you look at the matches on this card because it's not like it was a trash card on paper with just like the Heart Strike Force and Savage Honky, you know, and this outpaced them both for me easily. So, yeah, what do you think, Kel?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I agree. I mean, that was a awesome match. And a unique match in the context of the time. And, yeah, it's match of the night for me.
All right, the Cousin Junior, the worst match of the night. I thought, for me, it was an easy call. It was Warrior and Frenchie Martin, despite the injury. I mean, it was not trending well before that. And then Martin's getting broken and then everything from there. So,
no, I agree.
Yep.
All right, MVP, a bit of a cop-out. I hate doing the double, but I don't know how you can't. In my mind, not give it to the Jumping Bomb Angels and Glamour Girls. Like, I can't pick either or. I thought they were both fantastic. I thought they stood out on this night as the best.
Oh, no, I agree. I'm not a cop-out at all. They both deserve 50-50 for making that match great. Nobody carried the other.
I just went with the Angels. I mean, the girls were great as well. But this was, you know, a coming-out party for them. They stole the show. And, yeah, they're the MVP for me.
Gonna have to make me write separate.
Yep. I'm always that guy.
Yeah, for no reason. Guy. I mean, you could have said both.
Pete usually just nods, Kel.
Yeah. Nods off to sleep. You.
Very true.
All right, the Uncle Elmer Award for the worst worker. Fuck a Frenchie Martin. I can't stand him. I didn't cry when his shoulder broke.
That's fine. That's fine.
Sucks.
Jesus. I went with Putski. I mean. Martin, I mean, he's not great, but
the guy, he was the guy, terrible.
The guy dislocated.
He was terrible before that. That saved him. That made him gave him. Yeah. He felt
that's
a little bad for
having to be terrible any longer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm biased against bronzed midgets. So
all right.
Polish bronze,
Polish bronze, roided midgets.
Very targeted group there. All right, best moments. I went with Savage beating down Jimmy and Honky after the match and smashing him with a guitar. I thought that was the best part of the whole night.
Yep, I agree 100%. I was just going to say the guitar shot, but yeah, the beatdown after, just the whole post-match was good for me.
Well, I'll be difficult again. I mean, I enjoyed the post-match Savage Honky stuff, but I loved the double drop kick by the Angels. That was the highlight for me of the night.
All right. All right. The Arcidi Award, some competition here on this evening, but I this to me is an easy call, and that is his second. Well, he's won half last week, and he gets the full from me here tonight. That's Ivan Putski, the Polish power.
I will go with that, but we have a new contender for future house shows, and I don't think we can ignore the Ultimate Warrior too much.
No,
but,
I know.
We have a lot of contenders
right now, and you can look at the list of since May, and you see them all, right? Morocco, Bravo, Billy Graham, Morocco, Jim Powers, Morocco, Putski. There's plenty of juice flowing at this point.
Yeah, but we'll give it to Putski only because his juice does nothing for him. He's still a jobber. Yes, he's a juice jobber. But Warrior is now a new player in the mix for this award from here on out.
Yeah, I'm not waiting for anything for the Warrior. I'm giving it to him this month. He's not called the Anabolic Warrior by Dave Meltzer for no reason.
Anabolic Warrior.
Oh, God. All right, a lot of variants as usual with Kelly for these awards. all right, overall grade. interesting show. Like, there was some stuff in there that prevents it from being the best for me. I know I was a little bit lower on a couple of those big matches than you guys were. The jumping bomb make this a must watch, at least, you know, for that match was a must watch match. I thought Bigelow's debut, that match was a lot of fun. It's a historically like significant show, seeing DiBiase's first match back in this gimmick, Bigelow's first match, jumping bomb Angel's first match. Like, there's like a ton of debuts up and down this card, and you can really see that, you know, that like we talked about earlier, the flow coming around and changing in the company, this guy's disappearing and all these new faces showing up, and they're really refreshing things as we head into the new year. So I enjoyed the show quite a bit. I thought the commentary was fine enough, and there was some good moments. So I went 6 out of 10 on this one. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I'm looking at my previous house show grades.
Nine.
Please. I'm looking at yours. 1, minus 3, no. I mean, I've given 6s and 6.5s, but I mean, I have a 4 and 2 3.5s, and the one dud is because of an injury. I'm going to give this a 7. This was really good. I mean, everybody worked their asses off, and we have a memorable women's tag that literally comes out of nowhere. And then we have a great tag, and then we have another great IC title match. So it's hard for me to not give this at least a 7 with a 4
and
2 3.5s.
What was on the September show? That was Savage. Was that? I gave that a 6.5. I'm curious what that
was.
Yeah,
and I gave it a 5.5 because I think the rest of the
that was Savage off. Honky. That was a Savage Honky I really loved.
Yeah.
And that was Strikeforce
that was
Islanders,
Honky,
too.
But there was
Hogan
nothing.
Gang. No, there was much more than that. Strikeforce Islanders, I went 3.5. Gang,
yeah.
Hogan, I went 3. No, that was a good show. I'd say I like that one. Maybe a slight bump on this one. Whatever. I'll go say, all right, 6.5. I'll go 6.5. They're probably about the same.
Yeah. I'll give this one. I gave that one the rest of the card must have been more duds in that. That must have been the one that I gave like 3 duds to. I think it balanced out.
I think you're.
But other than the dud at the beginning, the rest of the show's pretty solid. I'll leave it out. I'll give 6.5 too. Maybe 7's a bit much, Kel.
Okay, we finally all agree. I give it 6.5 too. This was a pretty fun show. The opening match was a dud, but it was short. And the one snoozer for me was the tag between the Bees and the Russians, the Bolsheviks. I never want to see that again. But we had 3 really good matches, and the Angels Glamour Girls match was great. And the debuts, it's cool to see these guys when they're working out the kinks in their character. And the crowd was hot tonight. Not really. I don't recall any boring chants, so that's rare for an MSG show. And yeah. Much better than quite a few of the shows in the past, that's for sure.
That September show also had that awful Brad Rangan's fucking Tiger Chung Lee match with Steel and Sika. So there was definitely more blemishes in that September show. But
I just like the big matches a little bit better. Like, I like Strikeforce Islanders in that show better than this, and I think I liked Hogan Gang better than Savage Honky. So, I mean, that's whatever. Whatever. I gave it the same grade, so shut up. If you want to see that Bolsheviks match again, Kelly, you could probably watch Primetime from around this time. I'm sure they showed it sometime in November, December. I've actually been throwing those on like late at night, and I'm catching a lot of matches again here and there that they're showing from these time periods. So you'll probably run into that one if you watch those.
Oh, God. Yeah, no. Oh, God.
All right, let's put a pin in this one. We will be back next week, Scott, with Mr. D'Amato returns, of course, our pay-per-view guy, looking at Survivor Series, the premier one, debuting pay-per-view in 1987. So looking forward to that. Of course, it's a kind of an overlooked show historically, so we'll see if it holds up for us. And then from there, we have no promises for you from March into early April. Our schedules are quite hectic and chaotic. So we will try and be here with some semblance of regularity, but don't hold us to any kind of schedule over the next month or so. We'll keep you posted there. So, Scott, anything you want to talk about? Your main event or anything going on?
Yeah, last week we had a fantastic main event. Nate and I had our man Brandon Howard on to talk about the fourth quarter of 2017. And then we talked about Chad came on and we talked about our New Japan match pick of the week. This week, we will be dropping part two of Nate's and my 10-part series, breaking down our top 100 GWWE lists and see how it matches up with the list that you, Place to Be Nation, put together with your ballots that we are posting on the website piece by piece. So check that out. That'll probably drop on Wednesday. Hmm. So check that out.
I don't usually like main event. No, I'm kidding. But this was actually a really good one.
No shit. No, I'm only kidding. No.
No, this was a good one. Brandon was awesome. You guys talk in the fourth quarter. I thought a lot of good insights.
Yep.
Especially around like the cable deal and all that. Like that was some good stuff. And then I liked the New Japan segment really a lot too. Like the Bob Sapp conversation was all really interesting. So good listen. Check it out if you haven't yet. Also, Aaron and I's newest Made the Cut dropped earlier, I guess yesterday at this point, where I think we did 90 through 80 on that one. I don't know. We're kind of recording in pieces, but it's like an hour and a half on 10 slots. So check that out as we continue to reveal our list as well. Chad and Andy Labar did theirs. They did about 4 hours on their list as well. So check that out. So a lot of quality audio dropping around the GWWE. We have some more on the way, of course. PlaceNation.com each and every day. Kelly, what do you got going on?
Well, WorldCast drops every Wednesday with Pete and Johnny and myself. This week we're doing another WorldCast What If. Pete was out of the country or something, and
what
it's
if,
just Johnny and I.
What if Pete's awake? That's the what if.
Yeah. What if Pete makes it through a show without falling asleep? And he missed something that he would have scratched his eyes out on anyway, because Johnny and I are reviewing bloopers, bleeps, and body slams from Coliseum Home Video from the recent network drop.
I hope you make it more entertaining, because that I watched that one the other day, and that's rough. So, I'm going to listen to you guys. So I hope you can try and make it better for others that haven't watched it, because it's... You guys are torturing yourselves.
Well, yeah, no, it's definitely far from the best tape, but it's the first in the series, and that's
sort of
the gimmick.
Yep.
We always do the first of a new drop, so that's it.
Gorilla with no glasses, it's a little
unnerving. Yeah, it is unnerving. But no, we had a good time. We went over 2 hours, so yeah, we left no stone unturned on that tape, that's for sure. And yeah, that's what I got going on.
Well, be sure to check out all that quality audio on our feeds, PlaceMe Nation Wrestling, PlaceMe Nation Pop, and Pro Wrestling Only. Speaking of the Pop feed, be sure to, I think I plugged it last week, check it out, the debut of Talkin' Pop with Jennifer Smith and Tim Capel. I was on that, talking some non-wrestling and some wrestling, but some insights there to nonsense and good stuff, I thought, too.
Two more things to mention quick, JR, before we go out. Also in the Pop feed, the newest episode of Breaking Balls has been posted, so check out Greeny and Mr. Jordan, Mr. Barnhart with their newest baseball show. And as we're seeing on Raw right now, they're talking about the newest member of the WWE Hall of Fame, Mr. J-A-R-R-E-T-T. And we, of course, did a great episode with him back back a couple years ago. And that is up again. For those that may have missed it, check it out. We interviewed Mr. Jeff Jarrett.
Yeah,
and it was really good. It was one of our better shows.
You can search for PlayStation.com. It's linked on our social media as well. And I was actually proud of that one because that's when he was doing the GWF circuit. And like he was kind of talking about the same stuff with everyone. But we got him to like veer off of that and talked a lot about his career, like Dota F career, like early, like 93, 94 stuff. He seemed to have a good time with it. So I was actually proud of that one. I thought we got him off his circuit that he had been on.
Yeah, me too.
So check that out if you haven't, Scott. That's a good point. So that all said, check out everything each and every day. Facebook.com/PlayStation, Twitter, please. Number 2B Nation, PlayStation.com/Amazon. Do some shopping with us. You can help us out, keeping the site up and running. Download our free Vintage Vault ebooks as well. Plenty going on each and every day, both audio and written content. So there you go. And also, if you're attending WrestleMania in New Orleans and you want to be part of our gathering on Sunday afternoon, reach out to me. We'll talk more about it as we get closer, but I know there's probably going to be not as many of these episodes before then as you would think. Keep an eye on social media or just reach out to me if you want to meet up with us. No tailgate this year. Nick Duke's not going, and I refuse to do one when he's not involved. But also, I'm told the Superdome doesn't have a great setup for tailgating. So we're going to probably do a bar gathering and all meet up and hook up and hang out on a Sunday. So all that said, reach out to me if you're interested in that. Otherwise, we'll be back next week. Kelly will talk to you in like a month or so, maybe. Check out WorldCast and everything else. Otherwise, talk to you in a week. Bye.
With the president, dunking on his delegates, then I compliment him on his political etiquette. Toss a couple million, the air just for the heck of it, but keep the 520 tins and bins completely separate. Yeah, I'd be in a whole new tax bracket. We in recession, but let me take a crack at it. I probably take whatever's left and just split it up, so everybody that I love can have a couple bucks. And not a single tummy around me would know what hungry was, eating good, sleeping soundly. I know we all have a similar dream. Go in your pocket, pull out your wallet, put it in the air and sing. I wanna be a billionaire so fucking bad.
So bad.
Buy all of the things I never had.
Buy everything.
I wanna be on the cover of Forbes magazine. Smiling next to Oprah and the Queen.
What up, Oprah?
Oh, every time I close my eyes. A billionaire, so fucking bad.